So I hear about the ratings for the season opener of Total Divas crashing and burning. And then I see this video from Lana's Instagram live stream.
I guess we're going to rewatch the episode of Total Divas.
No, we're not watching that shite. We're not watching that anymore.
Thank you, Sheamus.
It's business time, baby.
The Sala Monster sounds off.
My client.
Mama Monster.
Conquered the street.
You like fighting a woman?
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
Come over here and fight me.
Delete. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Sheamus, speaking the truth there in that clip. I do like how some of the members of the League of Nations still hang out together. I don't know. That just makes me very happy to know that. But the Big Total Divas Season 8 premiere last week drew 454,000 viewers on the E! Network, by far the lowest rated season opener of all of them. They're on a downward trend the last 3 years. Season 5 opened with over 1 million viewers. It seems Sheamus has had enough, although he did go on to say in the clip that they just got done watching the, and I quote, fucking episode. His word, not mine. Anti-Total Divas misogynistic Sheamus could be a fun gimmick. Actually, Sheamus has his own YouTube channel. I don't know how many people are aware of this. I mean, it's got 150,000 subscribers, but I'm sure some of you don't know this. It's called Celtic Warrior Workouts. He does workouts with different... I mean, it's not just a WWE talent, but there are a lot of workout videos. They could be 30, 40, 50 minutes long with WWE stars. He just posted one with Becky Lynch. They're really good. I have to say, they're really good. He's done them with a bunch of people. Seth Rollins, AJ Styles, Daniel Bryan, Rusev, Charlotte, his own father. The one with his dad is actually really cool. He goes to his parents' home in Ireland, or maybe he was just home for a holiday. And he works out with his dad in his family's shed. I guess his dad, he's got a little gym in there. His dad used to be a bodybuilder, which I was not aware of. And even now, you look at this guy in the video, I don't know how old his father is, but his father looks great. His father looks to be in better shape than some of the main roster guys. So anyway, it's called Celtic Warrior Workouts. There's a little free, cheap plug for him there. If you haven't seen any of the videos, you can check that out. This is episode 565, I should probably get around to mentioning that, of the Sala Monster Sounds Off here for Sunday, September 23rd, 2018. I am the Sala Monster. It has been 500 episodes since my WrestleMania 25 review, which is not online at the moment. It is part of, I guess, what you would call the lost episodes. Actually, it was a two-parter. Part one was the WrestleMania review, and part two was the rest of the podcast. So one day, I'll roll them back out one day. I've had a few people ask me, hey, where can I get it? Where can I download it? Right now, nowhere, but one day that'll change. Thank you to Audible, as always, for being a good partner of the podcast. You can get your one free audiobook on the Sound Off. All you got to do is use our link, audibletrial.com/Sala Monster. And you don't just punch the link in. Make sure you sign up for the free trial because you get to sample the service for 30 days. And you get to choose one free audiobook, whichever one you'd like. You can download it for free. And even if you cancel your trial before the 30 days are up, you get to keep your book. All you got to do is punch it in, audibletrial.com/Sala Monster. Sign up and get your free book. If you want to become a PayPal VIP and show your support, you can do so on thesalamonster.com. $10 or more, you'll get the nickname and the shout-out as promised. And we got a bunch of shout-outs I just want to run through here. Thank you to all of our VIPs, including John Luz Cannon Lopez, the Florida Freebird Brian Pissarra, Deadpool James Herrera, Out of Control Cody Thomas, Beast Mode Brock Joseph, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, Raymond the Mountie Medina, Downtown Kenny Brown, the Malaysian Mastermind Samuel T, the Show-Off Corey Van Dam, the Chicago Slayer Willie Eichard, the Anarchist Andrew Heller, Stephen Handyman Halistick, the Renton Road Warrior Taylor Schatt, Mentally Unstable Matt Cotter, Cody Heartbreaker Hatch, the Reno Renegade Wayne Ashanti, the Portland Pop Star Paul Hamilton, the Orlando Commando Christopher Thompson, one of my favorite names, and Otter Nonsense Christopher and Lisa Wilkinson. Hope Chris and Lisa are doing well. Also, I want to shout out Mass Mayhem, Mikey Landreth. If you are a fan of pro wrestling, if you're a fan of horror movies, If you're a fan of cryptozoology and other assorted nonsense, you can check out the Not That Anyone Asked podcast, Not That Anyone Asked, hosted by twin brothers Dan and Mikey. Episodes include the highs and lows of the Halloween movie franchise, of which I am a fan, the story of the Mothman of Point Pleasant, the good, bad, and ugly of Dragon Con, and some WWE discussions as well. So you can find it for free right now. Go to patreon.com/LeonSDanson. That's all you got to do. John Contreras, Conrad Cushman, Trevor Jackson, Santos DeBarge, G the Gray, and Badman C. If you guys are listening, thank you very much for the 5-star rating and reviews you guys left for the show in iTunes. It helps out a lot. I appreciate that. There was another person who did not leave a name but said that they were a fairly new listener on a recommendation made by Wrestling Soup. So I want to thank Mish and Joey for their support and their mentions here and there. I do very much appreciate that. You all should go check out the Soup as well. Especially now, you know, the weather is taking a downturn finally, at least here in New York. No more of this 100% humidity with 95 degree temperatures every day. We're finally getting into the fall weather. And what better thing to have in the fall and the winter than some soup? I'm just saying. Thank you for getting me to 25,000 followers on Twitter and nearly 40,000 subs on YouTube. You know, we're down to only about, I'd say maybe what, 400, less than 400 away from 40K. I had said I wanted to get there by the end of the year. It looks like we may have a shot of getting there before the end of the month, but I need your help to do it. So head on over to youtube.com/thesolomonster and hit that sub button. Speaking of YouTube, actually, before I talk about Hell in a Cell, and for those of you who missed it, the full Hell in a Cell review is up on the YouTube channel. It's about 33 minutes long. What was, I thought, overall one of the better pay-per-views of the year. But before I get into that, and I'm going to give a little bit of a spoiler warning here for those of you who do not want to know what happened at the New Japan show earlier this morning. New Japan did have its destruction at, or I should say destruction in Kobe show. And again, skip ahead 2-3 minutes if you don't want to hear anything that happened on the show, because I am going to mention something here. I have not seen the match yet, but apparently the main event with Tanahashi and Okada had... Well, I mean, surprise, surprise, right? Another classic match in their series of classic matches. Tanahashi won. He has still got the briefcase for an IWGP Championship match at the Tokyo Dome in January. But after the match, Switchblade Jay White came out. He attacked both Tanahashi and Okada. Ghetto ran down, grabbed a chair out of White's hands, and then blasted Okada with the chair. Now, Ghetto and Okada had gone their separate ways after the G1 last month. They had been together for years and years. I mean, I was disappointed to hear that because to me, they were perfect together. They're sort of like, you know, Heyman and Lesnar in that I don't think they ever should be broken up. Ghetto did the talking for Okada most of the time. I guess now, after all these years, Okada's doing more and more talking. And also, I mean, let's be honest, Okada is already one of the greatest of all time to do what he does. He's not a rookie, you know. He's not a young. I shouldn't say he's not a young guy. I mean, it's kind of weird for me to say that. I don't even know. Is he 30? He's either 30 or about to turn 30. So I can't even call him an old man. But you know, he's been doing this now for a number of years, and I guess they just felt, you know, I guess in storyline the explanation was that, you know, Ghetto had done all he can do for Okada. Okada felt like, you know, he doesn't need him anymore, and so anyway, they were going their separate ways. So I guess in that respect, this betrayal should not have come as a surprise, but when I read about it, I was still surprised. So Ghetto has dumped Okada for Jay White. He didn't just dump him. He went with Jay White. They're really high on Jay White right now. That much is obvious. Ghetto said that Tanahashi is going to have to defend that briefcase next against White. I don't know when, I don't know what the date is on that, but if he wins, if Jay White were to win that match, it would be Jay White challenging Kenny Omega for the IWGP title at Wrestle Kingdom. I don't like that match as much as I like, you know, the idea of Omega against Tanahashi. I think, and again, this is just me riffing here, but I would think the top, you know, three matches at Wrestle Kingdom will be Omega against Tanahashi, Jay White against Okada, I would think, after what happened here. And Naito challenging Chris Jericho for the IWGP Intercontinental title, if Jericho ever defends that thing again. I don't know that he's defended it once since he won it. But I would think that they're probably setting up for Naito to win the belt back from him. So anyway, that is your New Japan update for those of you who were curious about the goings-on in New Japan since the G1. It's been kind of quiet, but they did have that show earlier this morning, and hopefully when the show is over, I will have a chance to go back and watch that main event, because I will never miss out on an opportunity to see an Okada-Tanahashi match. It's one of those, it's kind of like the New Day and the Usos. It happens so often that after a while, you're kind of like, eh, maybe they should separate them for a while. It's a little much. But I never really object to watching one of those matches, because they're always great, right? Great chemistry, great matches. So that's your New Japan update. Hell in a Cell. I did mention the Hell in a Cell pay-per-view. We got just shy of 4,000 votes in the poll I put up on Twitter. Final results, 65% thumbs up, 35% thumbs down. So overwhelmingly positive response to the show, more positive than negative. And like I said, it was an excellent show. I thought one of the best WWE shows of the year, with a craptacular main event finish. And even the match itself, frankly, the main event, it wasn't as though it was a Matt classic before the crappy finish. The match really wasn't that good. I mean, let's just be honest here. It was not very good. They send Dolph Ziggler out there and Drew McIntyre and Seth Rollins and Dean Ambrose, even before Brock Lesnar ran in, to brawl on top of the Cell for what felt like an eternity. The entire time Strowman and Roman are just laying down there, I guess, taking a nap. And they sent those guys out there to take all the big bumps. So anyway, between that and just the way they went off the air with it, while it was cool, to see Brock come back and rip the door off the Cell, you know, that was cool. But I was not a fan of that finish. And Brock Lesnar is back. That was, I guess, the biggest surprise of the night. Brock Lesnar is back. He's still going to be fighting in UFC, at least he plans to, early next year. But as Braun Strowman might say, you know, he's not finished with this company, because when you wave a bunch of money in his face, that's the easiest way to get Brock Lesnar's interest, and so that's why he is back. And we'll talk more about that in a second. But a few other notes here before we get into what happened on Raw Monday night. PW Insider had the scoop this week on a meeting between WWE officials and Impact officials. Ed Nordholm and Scott D'Amore representing Impact Wrestling. No mention of Don Callis in this story, but those two met with several, quote, high-ranking WWE executives last week in Stamford. One WWE source apparently described the meeting as just a general discussion about the two companies and just kind of a getting-to-know-you type of thing. The Observer says the belief is that it had to do with the WWE Network and the Impact Tape Library. Not that the library is for sale, because it's not, but possibly to come to some kind of an agreement where WWE would have access to it when needed. Now, they've licensed footage from Impact before for some DVDs and some network specials. If you remember that great special on the Hardys, there was footage from Final Deletion and some of, you know, the broken Matt Hardy stuff. And that was not the first time that they've used footage. And what they do typically is they credit the, it was a GWN, I think it is, the Global Wrestling Network, whatever the streaming services that Impact has. They just give them a credit and they put the logo in the corner of the screen. So they've worked together before in that way. This does not mean the company is up for sale. All of a sudden, there's rumors starting up again. That means Impact is for sale. Apparently, that is not the case. And look, it's good to see the two companies on speaking terms. Now we can just have Vince McMahon get over his phobia of even acknowledging them on television. You know, for every time the announcers, and it doesn't happen often, but for every time the announcers mention, you know, New Japan, a little mention of IWGP, this guy was JBL used to do this all the time. This guy's an IWGP champion. It's okay to mention that, but, you know, it's blasphemy if you were to mention the name Impact or if you ever mentioned the TNA initials. It was very obvious that was something on the banned list of terms, probably still is. I'm not quite sure why that is. And frankly, I think it's incredibly stupid when you consider that half the damn roster now in WWE feels like it's made up of Impact alumni, including some of the biggest names, including the two guys feuding over the WWE Championship right now, which used to be their crown jewel, no pun intended, and obviously is no longer. Now that's the belt that Roman Reigns has. But yeah, the two guys that have been feuding over the WWE title were just longtime Impact talents that, you know, made a name for themselves really there, at least on television. I know Joe had that run as ROH champion, but anyway, so I like the fact that they're at least on speaking terms. Who knows what they may do in the future? Maybe they'll work together in other ways. We'll see. But on the subject of Impact, I wanted to mention this as well. They're going to be honoring Abyss as their newest inductee into the Impact Hall of Fame. It's been a while since we've had a new inductee into the Impact Hall of Fame. And they're going to be honoring Abyss, special ceremony at Mikhail's Bar and Grill in Midtown Manhattan the night before Bound for Glory. That's Saturday, October 13th. They've made a limited number of tickets available for this. I will be there. I actually bought my ticket to see Abyss be inducted. And since they're doing this at a bar, we can all get shit-faced afterwards. So to me, it was a win-win situation. You get to see somebody, one of the good guys get honored, and then you get to drink yourself into oblivion. But I was really happy when I heard that Abyss was being honored, because you talk about somebody who has been fiercely loyal to that company, okay, for so many years. The abuse that this guy puts his body through, stupidly, I think, in many cases, but yeah, the abuse that he takes, and I don't, you know, if anybody deserves to be honored, I think, for their contributions to that company over the years, because there's a lot of people who jump ship. And I'm not just talking former WWE guys who came in for a payday, and then when the well ran dry, they you know, hightailed it back to Vince McMahon. There were a lot of guys who were very loyal for a very long time to that company who reached their breaking point, whatever their reasons were. Creative differences, they weren't being paid, you know, they could just see, you know, like rats on a sinking ship, and they left. You can go down the list. AJ Styles, Bobby Roode, Samoa Joe, Austin Aries. I mean, just on and on and on. And the one guy who stayed true to Impact, whether it be to his detriment or to his credit, that's, I guess that's in the eye of the beholder. Everybody has an opinion on that. But it was Abyss. Abyss never left. He's one of the TNA originals who is still there to this day. And, you know, here's a guy who, by his own admission, a few years ago on Jim Ross's podcast, said that when his contract with TNA was coming up in 2006, Tommy Dreamer got conversations going between Abyss and WWE. They wanted to bring him in. There was interest from WWE in bringing this guy in. And I guess this wasn't set in stone or anything, but his understanding, or what he was told, was that the plan would have been not just to debut him and bring him in, but to debut him at the Royal Rumble in 2007 and then go on to work a match with The Undertaker, WrestleMania 23, in Detroit. And he backed out at the last second. I don't know if they had a verbal agreement or they thought they were going to, you know, they were close to having an agreement, but apparently in the 11th hour, he got cold feet and backed out. Tommy Dreamer said that he got stage fright. You know, Abyss said, no, it wasn't stage fright. It was more just out of loyalty to TNA. I felt a loyalty to this brand. And he thought, look, this is 2006 at the time. He thought TNA is in a good place. And he really wanted to be part of something new, of something special. And he thought that that was the direction that TNA was headed in. I think a lot of people probably thought around 05, 06. Some people would even call those the golden years, the peak years of TNA. Others would say maybe it was, 2012. But that was his rationale for changing his mind, backing out, and staying in TNA. This guy gave up a WrestleMania match, quite possibly, with The Undertaker in front of 75,000 people to work for Dixie Carter. Instead, what happened? The Undertaker won the Royal Rumble that year. And he went on to beat Batista for the World Heavyweight title at WrestleMania in a pretty damn good match. But I doubt very many people would have turned down that opportunity. He did. Now again, was it smart? What a loyal guy. What a stupid guy. You know, I don't know. He felt he made the decision that was right for him at the time. I guess they were paying him well, and he obviously liked the people that he worked with, and he was happy. And so, you know, why ruin a good thing? But someone on my timeline suggested that they have Joseph Park do the induction. See, now that would be fun. How they would pull that off, I don't know. But that would be fun. Well, I guess as long as they're not in the same, they don't have to technically be in the same place at the same time. I think it should be Father James Mitchell. doing the induction, but I was a big fan of the Joseph Park angle. You guys know that. One of my favorite segments they did with him was one of those backstage segments. I think it was when he met Sting for the very first time. And he, you know, he goes over to Sting and he's like, I don't want to kayfabe you. He was always dropping these insider terms. And I don't know, that whole thing. It was just the whole gimmick was just a guilty pleasure of mine. He's a lot like their version of Kane, right? And not just in terms of all the times that he's returned and he's got the mask, which is kind of similar. I always pegged him as a cross between Mankind and Kane. I wouldn't say a ripoff because that's sort of an insult, but looks-wise, he was definitely a mix between Mankind and Kane, but he reminds me of Kane and how versatile he is, just in terms of what he can do for the company that he works for, right? So if they want him to be the monster and use thumbtacks and barbed wire, then he could be the monster. If they want him to do more comedy and be more of a comedic figure, or do things like the Joe Park stuff, he could do that too. He was a good little soldier who did whatever was asked of him. He gave the company the best years of his career, I think it's safe to say. And I think it's very cool that he'll have this moment for himself. Rey Mysterio, who has been rumored for a WWE return ever since his cameo in this year's Royal Rumble match, where he got that huge reaction, he looked like he had just physically turned back the hands of time. He has officially signed a 2-year deal with WWE per PW Insider. The deal has a clause where at the 18-month mark, if he wants to, he can give notice and he can get out of the deal early. I would like to see him go to SmackDown. SmackDown, you know, that was his home for so many years. And I just look at that roster and I like a lot of those matchups more than I do him going to Raw. I don't know. There's just something, well, we can get into all the reasons that Raw is the way it is. But I don't know. Raw just doesn't feel like the right place for him. And, you know, he goes to SmackDown. He could work with guys like AJ Styles, Andrade Cien Almas, Daniel Bryan, Shinsuke Nakamura. You know, there's cruiserweights. You know, we're talking about main roster talent here, but there's cruiserweights on that 205 Live show that I would love to see mix it up with Rey Mysterio. I mean, think about it. Who better for them to work with? Not that they have to. I'm just talking in terms of these matches, right? Kind of past versus present. Who better for them to work with than the greatest cruiserweight of all time? But only if they allowed some of those guys to make appearances again on main roster shows. I don't think Rey Mysterio, I'm sure for all the money they're probably signing him for, you don't want to relegate him just to being on 205 Live. And I'm skeptical about how much that would even help the show in terms of bringing in new viewers. I'm not even sure it would be worth it to stick him on there. It would kind of be like putting Christian on ECW back in the day. They had this whole big storyline supposedly lined up for him to come back at the Royal Rumble that year. I think it might have been 09. And then word leaked. Remember that? And so Vince McMahon made the decision to put him on ECW instead. And I mean, I guess for some of the guys he worked with, he was working with Swagger, he was working with Ezekiel Jackson. I'm sure for them it was a positive to get to work with somebody like Christian. I don't know that it did a whole lot of good for Christian's career. But, you know, I mentioned the whole thing of if you're going to do that, though, the cruiserweights would have to start making more appearances on the main roster shows and not the other way around, with Ray being on 205 Live. And Kurt Angle actually pitched a great idea during a Facebook Q&A that he did the other day, and he mentioned Ray actually by name. Somebody asked him if he thinks the WWE should integrate 205 Live talent more into the main roster, which they had been doing for a while. The problem is that nobody gave a shit. Right, when they were on Raw, it was just a bunch of random cruiserweight matches, and because people weren't following along with the storylines on 205 Live, and also maybe they just didn't care. Sometimes it was the positioning, it would be late in the show, in the third hour, and I mean, who could possibly care at that point? So anyway, it didn't work, and so they stopped putting them on Raw, or maybe they just felt like 205 Live had already been firmly established, we don't need to put them on Raw anymore, and they vanished. And we haven't seen cruiserweights on Raw until now with these new managers. We haven't seen them on Raw since. So anyway, this person asked Kurt during the Facebook Q&A this question. And his idea was that WWE should highlight one cruiserweight each month. So every month, you'd have a different star from the 205 Live roster appearing on Raw and SmackDown. And his idea is, you see which one the fans really get behind, and then you push them. Now, right there, his idea is already a fail, because his idea is predicated on the whole notion that WWE is going to actually gauge the crowd reaction and listen to the fans and let the fans guide their decision-making, and they've already made it very clear recently that that just isn't what they do. Not anymore. But anyway, the idea would be that you would gauge the crowd reaction, see who the fans get behind, and then push them. And then Kurt said, then voila, you have the next Rey Mysterio. I wouldn't go that far. Rey Mysterio, you can't make guys like him in a factory and just churn them out. I don't really think it works that easily. But his basic idea, I think, is actually a very good one. Now, I've sung the praises of someone like Mustafa Ali on this podcast before. This guy was turned down by WWE 5 years ago when he first tried out. They turned him down. They said that he wasn't what they were looking for. And I would love if somebody could even maybe look this up, because I didn't, but I would love to know if he was turned down from the same class that Ricochet was turned down from. Because if you remember Ricochet's story, he had a tryout a few years ago with WWE, and it wasn't that he disappointed people, but they turned him down. Triple H turned him down by saying, we have enough people who basically look like you and wrestle like you, or who were small like you. We've kind of reached our small guy quota, and they actually, this is a company that turned down Ricochet. I would love to know if that was the same year they turned down Mustafa Ali. This would have been 2013. But anyway, so he comes back from that, right? He ends up in the Cruiserweight Classic. I didn't know anything about this guy. And I started watching his matches and he won me over. There's an example of something. Now, imagine a guy like Mustafa Ali on the main roster working his Caucasian doppelganger, Seth Rollins. Or working a program with Shinsuke Nakamura for the United States Championship. Or maybe not even a program, but just one match for the United States Championship. Or wrestling Jeff Hardy or Finn Balor, Almas, Bryan. And yes, Rey Mysterio. There is not a doubt in my mind that that guy would get over huge. And you could say the same thing for somebody like a Buddy Murphy. So I think Kurt's idea is a great idea. But like I said, it's predicated on the notion that WWE is going to do this and kind of put their ear to the door and listen and gauge the crowd reaction and go with whoever the fans appear to be into. And color me skeptical that they would actually do that. PW Insider also had some, boy, they were on a roll this week. They had some exclusive news on the future of Pentagon and Phoenix. Now, I said last week it looked like they were not going to WWE after all. There's been a lot of rumors that they are, they're not. There certainly was and continues to be interest from the WWE side. I'm sure they would love to have those guys under contract. I was very happy, though, when I heard that they were not going, because I just think that would have been a bad move for them to make right now. Those two are in demand. Apparently, their deals with Lucha Underground are such that they're locked into a non-compete through the year 2020. Now, that doesn't mean they couldn't get out of it, possibly, but they're under a non-compete until 2020, and it's, you know, given all the other places that they're working, I'm not really sure how that non-compete works, because they're on no less than three different television shows. It's not like, well, they're working indies and stuff. They're on TV right now here in the U.S. They're on at least three different wrestling TV shows, including Lucha Underground, and so I guess, I guess it only really applies to WWE, and maybe Ring of Honor. Because anyway, the other news is that it's looking like they are going to be extending their deal with Impact Wrestling to work more dates for the company next year, for more money. They're getting a raise and they're going to work more for Impact next year. Plus, Court Bauer confirmed that the Lucha Bros are committed at least through the end of 2019 to be part of the MLW roster. And of course, they're also working dates in Mexico for AAA. They're working dates in Mexico for CMLL. And apparently they're looking at getting into New Japan next year. So these guys are, just like I said, they're in demand. I don't know that they could fit any more work or any more dates into their schedule. They're booked all over the place. And if they end up in New Japan next year, I got to say, the idea of a Pentagon Minoru Suzuki match, to me that would be maybe the most interesting match I could think of for Pentagon. But even Phoenix, you know, I talk about Pentagon a lot. Phoenix is one of the most talented guys in all of wrestling right now. I mean, seriously, we're talking top five, maybe top three. That's how good this guy is. So you put him in the ring with anybody over there, and, you know, they're going to tear the house down. So that excites me You know, I may not be watching Impact or New Japan week to week like I do WWE, you know, to review here on the show, but the idea that, you know, they could be working in all of these different places and you know, working with all different types of talent from all over the world, I see that as nothing but a positive. So I'm very happy that they are not going to WWE, and I'm very happy that, you know, these guys found success, and really it goes back to Lucha Underground. I don't know that Lucha Underground gets enough credit. You know, people like to say, well, Lucha Underground peaked, I don't watch anymore, the show, you know, barely gets any viewers anymore. The reality is that a lot of the guys on that show, and not just Pentagon Phoenix, you can maybe say Cage, and these are guys that were already working for other, you know, promotions, but it was the exposure that those guys and those characters got on Lucha Underground. You know, it may have only been a niche audience. You know, we're not talking a million viewers every week, but it was those characters and the exposure they got through that show here in this country that helped elevate them to a point where they are some of the most requested, sought-after talent on the independent scene. I don't know that, you know, is Pentagon and Phoenix as popular and hot as they are now if they don't first get over on Lucha Underground? I can't say for sure. I mean, they're talented guys. They probably would have been successful anyway. Would they be as in demand now as they are? I don't think so. I really don't. I don't know that that Lucha Underground gets enough credit for that. The concussion lawsuits brought against WWE, which date back all the way to early 2015, when Big Vito LaGrasso, first brought suit against the company, and then in the ensuing years, dozens and dozens of other wrestlers added their names as plaintiffs. There was this one lawyer who was going fishing for as many wrestlers as he possibly could find, and convincing them that it was a good idea for them to be added to this lawsuit. Well, those suits were all thrown out this week by Judge Vanessa Bryant. Not only were they all dismissed, but the judge ruled that Constantine Kyros, the lawyer who filed the cases, will have to pay all of WWE's court costs. And given how long this has dragged on for, I'm sure that is a pretty hefty amount. There were well in excess of 50 names. It might have been double that. I mean, I don't know what the exact number was in terms of the total number of plaintiffs, but there were well north of 50 names on that list, from Paul Orndorff to One Man Gang, Shane Douglas, Butch Reed, King Kong Bundy, Demolition, just, you know, and some more current names too. Tons of other names, many of which wrestled all over the world, not just for Vince McMahon, which is part of what made this so complicated. Should WWE be held responsible for the brain injury suffered by these people? Is it their fault? Should they be held accountable? I sympathize with some of these guys. Others, I'm sure, are just looking to make a quick buck. One name on that list is Chavo Guerrero. Actually, Chavo Sr. was on that list too, but so was Chavo Jr. And I ranted about this last year on the podcast when his name first came up in this. This guy throws his name into the hat. If you read the court documents, he said he suffers from headaches and anxiety and memory loss and insomnia and involuntary muscle spasms and all these horrible things. And yet he's still wrestling. He's still taking chair shots to the head on television. Like, if you're suing WWE over head trauma, you shouldn't be out there taking chair shots to the skull and wrestling. Right? I mean, I guess you got to make a living so you can wrestle. But like, you see some of these guys and the contradictions there, and it would be, you know, funny if it wasn't so sad. It's just one of those things where WWE was either too lax about the safety of their performers years ago when it came to stuff like this, which they were. I don't doubt that they were. Or it could be that people who, you know, worked for them behind the scenes may have even encouraged certain risky behavior, risky spots during matches. I don't doubt that some of that happened. But it's complicated, because unless you can prove that, how do you prove that your migraines and that your memory loss are their fault? When in a lot of these cases, if not all of these cases, these people wrestled hundreds, if not thousands of matches over the course of their career in other promotions where they probably did even less to protect the talent. Whatever WWE was doing, even if you think at the time it may have been the bare minimum, I can guarantee you that if these guys were working for smaller promotions that didn't have as much money as Vince McMahon had, they probably were doing even less than the bare minimum. I mean, you had plaintiffs on this list who spent the majority of their time in WCW and other places, and then maybe wrestled a couple of matches for WWE, who wanted a payday out of this. So anyway, the whole thing's been thrown out. The lawyer for the plaintiffs, he claims that he'll be taking this to appeals court, to which WWE attorney Jerry McDevitt gave this statement. This is the statement that he gave to PW Insider. He said, "This is the same kind of drivel that Kiros pawned off on former wrestlers when soliciting them to sue WWE by false statements that he had obtained a $1 billion settlement for NFL players and would do the same for wrestlers when, in fact, he had absolutely nothing to do with getting that settlement. He was caught repeatedly making false allegations. He has been admonished repeatedly by the federal judges about his dishonest behavior. And now he has been subjected to two different sanction orders of the kind that would make most lawyers embarrassed and ashamed. The rant he sent you now insults the federal judge who issued the decision, and he still fails to address the basis of her opinion. He may well have been able to mislead those he solicited to join his lawsuits, but he will never succeed in misleading us or federal judges. Frankly, he should be disbarred." When I think of the different MVPs in that company over the years, you know, some say Vince McMahon is the ultimate MVP, right? It's his promotion. Once he took it over from his father, he was the puppet master. He pulled all the strings. He made all the final decisions. Still does. Others might say Kevin Dunn, for all the flack that he gets. He's been there for very long, all the years he's worked there, and that he's done on the production end. Some good, a lot very bad. Some might say Jim Johnston, as important as all of his music was in helping get certain talents over. And believe me, music was a very important part, and still is, of that company for many, many years. There's some iconic themes that I would argue the theme songs got some guys over more than their in-ring talent did. So you could say any one of those guys were MVPs over the years for this company and did a lot to keep the WWE machine going. You could argue Hulk Hogan and Steve Austin. You know who the real MVP has been for all these years? Jerry effing McDevitt. They should put that on a t-shirt and sell it on WWE Shop. Jerry effing McDevitt. All the jams that this guy has gotten Vince McMahon out of over the years. You know, going back even to the steroid trial in the mid-90s. The money that he has saved this company. This guy is the real MVP. Little trivia note. His very first WWE client all the way back in 1987 was the recently deceased Jim the Anvil Neidhart. Neidhart had supposedly punched a flight attendant in an argument over drinks, and McDevitt got him acquitted. And that was the beginning of the relationship that now has gone on, I guess it would be in excess of 30 years now. But like I said, this guy has this guy has proven to be the real MVP for this company.
We welcome you tonight, live, to Monday Night Raw.
I think that sucks.
Raw last Monday night was live from Dallas, Texas. Dallas, traditionally a great wrestling city. They deserve better than this. Over 3,600 votes in the Twitter poll, 12% thumbs up. Wow, what a whopping number. 29% thumbs down. 59% did not watch. And actually, that third hour just collapsed. On Monday night. Shockingly, too, with a Roman Reigns Baron Corbin main event. I'm stunned. Although, to be fair, there was some competition on television. The Emmys, I think, right? Were the Emmys that night? And there may have been a football game. Anyway, I rage quit Raw. Once I saw Victor of the Ascension out there as Chad Gable's opponent. Gable was in the ring. This was in the first hour. Gable's in the ring. They cut to commercial. And I said to myself, if they put fucking Victor of the Ascension in that ring as his opponent after two straight weeks of Gable and Rude against the Ascension, with Gable pinning Victor each time, I'm done with this show for the rest of the night. It will be an early night for me. And sure enough, they come back and it's Victor of the Ascension. So I turned the show off and I caught up with it on DVR over the next couple of days so I could finish this review. But I just thought to myself, you know, what is even accomplished? What is accomplished by beating the same lower card guy three straight times like that? Is that supposed to make Chad Gable look like he's actually accomplished something? Is that the idea here? Is that the goal? I mean, I'm happy to see Gable getting airtime finally. But beating Victor of the Ascension 3 weeks in a row, I feel like I'm trapped in this infinite loop of muck and despair. That's what they should rename this show. Monday Night Muck. Monday Night Loop of Muck and Despair. And this was after a good match with Drew McIntyre and Dean Ambrose. I thought the two of them had a good little match. McIntyre won with the Claymore kick, which was the right outcome. But I don't know. I just saw that and I flipped out and I said, I can't. I just can't. That's it. I'm done. So, like I said, I went back and caught up on everything else. But before I turned the show off, came the beginning of the show, the opening segment. And the big news coming out of that segment was that on Friday, November 2nd, WWE is returning to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia for another network special. This one is called WWE Crown Jewel. And on that show, Baron Corbin announced it will be Roman Reigns defending his Universal Championship against Braun Strowman and Brock Lesnar in a triple threat match. Also on that show, they will be holding the first ever WWE World Cup tournament to determine, and I quote, the best in the world. So it looks like we're getting Okada versus Omega again, only this time in Saudi Arabia. I am intrigued by the World Cup concept. They haven't explained how it's going to work. They haven't said a word about who's going to be involved. I think TNA used to do a World Cup. I'm pretty sure they had something like a World, or maybe it's the X Cup that I'm thinking of. But in either event, this is not a new concept in wrestling. It would be new for WWE, so I am curious how they're going to work this. I'm sure it's just going to end up being, you know, they'll have Sheamus representing Ireland and Rusev representing Bulgaria. They'll just take people from the current roster. It would be kind of nice, though, if they did sort of invite talent from other promotions. They put something together where they worked some other people in there, if only for one night. But I don't think that's what they're going to be doing. So let's look at this. We have the Greatest Royal Rumble. We have the UK Championship Tournament from Royal Albert Hall. We have the Mae Young Classic, which is back. The Mixed Match Challenge is back. Super Showdown in Australia in 2 weeks. The All Women's Evolution Show. And then less than a week after that, Crown Jewel in Saudi Arabia. That's a lot of network specials this year. That's a lot of special shows. They're not all network specials. That's a lot of special shows this year. Two pay-per-views in 2 weeks at the end of next month sounds like overkill to me. But I guess that'll be more reviews up on my YouTube channel. So hey, I guess the more the merrier. You know, the last time they ran in Saudi Arabia, they aired a video on the screen inside the stadium that dared show one of the women. She wasn't naked. She wasn't performing sex acts. It wasn't a live chatterbait stream. It was literally footage of one of the WWE women that just happened to be, I think, in one of the commercials that they were airing for the next pay-per-view, whatever the next pay-per-view was, Extreme Rules maybe. And this nearly caused an international incident. They publicly shamed WWE over it. They put a whole statement out basically admonishing them. So I'm looking at this and I'm like, you know, if they do have a DX reunion on that show, and it sure looks like they will if they have DX against The Undertaker and Kane, and they do any crotch chops on that show, what do you think the punishment will be? Shawn Michaels coming out and prancing out to Sexy Boy? What do you think? Sentenced to 15 years hard labor, maybe? They better think this through before they go back over there. Lesnar is getting a reported 7-figure payday for this show. Not bad for a day's work. In a match where he'll probably be laid out and let the other two guys do most of the work. I don't see a title change here on this show. But I do think Braun needs a big win going into the Saudi Arabia show. Maybe on that Australian show, they're going to be doing a 6-man tag. I think him pinning Roman Reigns on that show would make a lot of sense. The other big thing on this show, I guess this sort of leads into this. This is one of the things I had to go back and watch that I missed, was The Undertaker. Undertaker came back. Boy, Undertaker is just making... He's making his shots here now, right? He's coming out here every couple weeks now. He's got something to say. He can't shut this guy up. Undertaker comes out, and he basically announces that since Triple H is going to have Shawn Michaels in his corner for their last ever but not really match in Australia, he is going to have Mayor Jacobs in his corner to help combat Shawn Michaels. I love how Kane gets elected mayor of Knox County. Like, he just got elected mayor. It's not like they were really doing much with him. They did bring him back to do the Team Hell No reunion. But before that, we hadn't seen Kane on television in months and months and months. And so this guy gets elected, and already he's back making trips to Australia. He's probably going to make the trip to Saudi Arabia. But anyway, this all but confirms that we're getting a tag team match at Crown Jewel with Shawn Michaels coming out of retirement. This looks like it's finally really going to happen after all of the teases over the years of Shawn coming back for one more match. And we thought maybe in 2013 it looked like, boy, he's going to work a match with Daniel Bryan at WrestleMania, and then he didn't. It looks like this is for real. It's like that, what is it, was that meme from The Office? This is really happening, right? Calm down, this is really happening. So it looks like that's what we're headed for in Saudi Arabia. Undertaker and Kane against Triple H and Shawn Michaels. Now, I personally like the idea better that somebody wrote in and floated on the in the mailbag section of the podcast a few weeks ago, where it would be Michaels and Triple H against Undertaker and Sting. Because storyline-wise, you could easily explain, you know, Sting's involvement. Plus, you get, if they're not going to wrestle, you at least get to see Undertaker and Sting team up one time, which would be kind of cool for nostalgia. I get why it can't happen. There's medical reasons, so I get it. But I do like that match better. So, Kane is coming back. Kane reunited with Daniel Bryan. Now he's going to reunite with The Undertaker. It's like Kane's greatest hits here. He's back on tour. When do we get that Kane and X-Pac reunion? I don't care what anybody says. I was a fan of that Kane and X-Pac tag team. I liked Kane and X-Pac. So when does he get back together with him? When does Kane get back together with Tori? Or try to have another baby with Lita? You just run through all of his greatest hits here. Well, I don't know if I'd call that last one. I don't know if greatest is the word I would use for that. So Shawn Michaels, let's talk about him here for a little bit. Because like I said, it sure looks like he's coming out of retirement this time. The money offer, I'm sure, was just too great for him to turn down. Why else would he suddenly have a change of heart and agree to come back? Now, he has said before that he would be open to the idea of coming back if it was not for a singles match, but like a tag team match, a DX thing with Triple H where he doesn't have to put as much pressure on himself. You know, I don't see this being a comedy match. I mean, if it's Shawn and Triple H against Undertaker and Kane, you know, that's going to be the feature match on any show. And my guess is it leads to at least one, if not multiple, singles matches, maybe at WrestleMania, maybe at other random shows. I don't see this as being a one and done. I hope not for Shawn Michaels. I mean, as much as I wanted to see him do what very few have done and honor the retirement stipulation from WrestleMania, but look, when you have that much money flashed in your face, if I had to take a guess, this guy's getting $1 million or more. I haven't read that. I have no idea. Maybe he's getting $750 and not $1 million. Whatever he's getting is a lot of money. And when you have that much money flashed in your face, you know what? You'd be a fool to turn it down. So I don't blame him one bit. I don't blame him one bit. But if he is back, I hope it's for more than just one random, meaningless tag team match. It has meaning if it leads to something. If it's going to lead to a singles match at WrestleMania, great. I would not mind Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker at WrestleMania 35. You know, would it be as good as 25? Think about it, it's going to be 10 years. That is insane for me. I'm sitting here thinking about this, and it is insane for me to think that we could possibly be setting up for a Shawn Michaels-Undertaker match at WrestleMania 35 when you think WrestleMania 25, WrestleMania 26. Undertaker physically was in, you know, much better shape back then. He still looked pretty good. But even then, the guy was banged up. Even back then, people were talking about when's his last match going to be? He's coming to the end of his rope. You know, 2010 was really where I started to see like a decline. He was gone for a while. He came back. And there was something very off about him. I don't know. He may have had hip issues, whatever it was. We're now going to be 10 years removed from that, and we're sitting here talking about the very real possibility of another Shawn Michaels Undertaker match. Like, these guys just, it's just unbelievable to me. It is unbelievable. This man is not disintegrated into a mound of dust, but somehow he soldiers on. He somehow is able to just keep going. You know what? I kind of admire that. I do find it sad, though, you know, for all these guys that have come back and now they're bringing back guys to get big paydays on these Saudi Arabia shows. Shawn Michaels may be coming back. It makes me sad to think that Bret Hart is not physically in a better way where he can come back and have and still be able to wrestle kind of at the level that he used to wrestle at. Obviously, he can't do that anymore. And it makes me sad because think, you know, the idea that we could be getting Bret Hart Shawn Michaels matches today. You know, a whole new generation could be exposed to, you know, the Bret Shawn feud. They could have continued that feud, and that was never really an option. Yeah, because Bret's my all-time favorite, and that, you know, obviously that rivalry was very real that they had in the late 90s, but it made for some great television, and it made for some great matches, and for all these big names that they bring back, it's too bad that Bret can't be one of them, because I think, I don't have any doubt in my mind that if he was still physically, you know, able to and didn't have the stroke and all the residual effects of it, I don't doubt that Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels would still be able to go out there and probably have the best match on the entire show. Vince McMahon has apparently changed his tune that managers are too old school wrestling, because not only do we now have two new ones on this show in Drake Maverick and now Leo Rush, they even referred to Leo on commentary as a manager. Not an advocate, not an agent, a manager, which apparently was a word that you just didn't use for a while there, and now it's back in the vocabulary. I endorse this idea. I like the Lashley-Leo Rush combo a lot. I think it'll end up probably getting Leo Rush more over than it will Lashley, which I don't know if that's the intended effect, but I like it. And I died when Leo interrupted Elias, and Elias just goes, "Whose kid is this?" I just thought that was a great line. So Leo's out there doing commentary for Lashley against Elias, which went to a no decision when Kevin Owens came out. He immediately turned to where the announce desk was, went right after Leo. Leo got away from, he threw an announce chair at him that Leo just was narrowly able to dodge. Leo's out there, he's weaving, he's bobbing around, trying to get away from Owens and Elias, and Lashley saves him, and then at the end, when they go to celebrate, Lashley hoists him up onto his shoulders, and Leo falls backwards. Lashley held onto his legs. This, I think, could turn out to be a real bright spot on the show going forward. So the whole idea of introducing some of the cruiserweights in, you know, whether they're all introduced as managers or maybe they find other roles for them in some way, or it goes to the idea that we were talking about earlier with Kurt Angle, where, you know, that he pitched, where he thinks that they should highlight one cruiserweight from that 205 Live roster on Raw and SmackDown each month. That's another great idea. I heartily endorse that because I think there's a lot of talent on that show. And I hear from you guys sometimes, hey, you know, you should really check out the 205 Live main event this week. It was really good. And it sucks that these guys are still performing in front of half empty buildings. And by the way, that was with them taping 205 Live before SmackDown. They actually did tape 205 Live before SmackDown this past week. But apparently there was some sort of error with the time listed on the ticket where it was listed as a start time of 6:30, and then they started at 6:15. It's like they just can't win. So these guys are out there, and they're performing in front of a half-empty crowd, not because people didn't care, but because the ticket time listed was later than what it actually turned out to be. So, but the idea of introducing these guys in this way on TV is, I think, a thumbs-up idea, and I'd like to see them do more of it. We had Ronda Rousey. She was on the show issuing an open challenge for her Raw Women's title. We heard Natty's music. She got dragged out by the Riot Squad. They dragged her dead body out there. And I will say this, you know, in the ensuing brawl that happened, I got to show some love for that spear that Ruby Riott hit Ronda Rousey with. That was better than any spear I've seen in a WWE ring since Goldberg came back. You got to go back and watch that. Now, that's a spear. What Ruby did, that is a spear. So I got to give her credit for that. Sasha Banks and Alexa Bliss both nursing injuries. They are out of the mixed match challenge. Alexa was to have teamed with Braun Strowman again. She suffered some kind of an arm injury that appears to be real. It's not just selling that awful arm bar that Rousey put on her at Hell in a Cell. She's been replaced by Ember Moon in the tournament. And now Sasha Banks suffered some sort of undisclosed injury, and she is out of the mixed match challenge. And replacing her as Lashley's partner is Mickie James. So hopefully these injuries are not serious enough to keep them out of that Evolution show. Not that they have anything even remotely scheduled or teased right now for Sasha on that show, although the rumor was a match with the Riot Squad, but hopefully they're okay, and they'll be back in time for that show. Roman Reigns against Baron Corbin, I mentioned before, that was the scheduled main event here on this show. Now, it was a Universal Championship match. It is nice to see the Universal title defended every now and then on television for a change. That being said, if I knew when Brock Lesnar was champion that once the title got on Roman Reigns, we would have Roman Reigns versus Baron Corbin matches, I would just as soon keep that title on Brock Lesnar for another 2 years. This was not a main event that was going to bring in very many viewers. It did not. It was not a very good match. Surprise, surprise. And you know, Roman Reigns has had plenty of good main events on Raw. Baron Corbin. There are times, look, Baron Corbin, some of the matches he's had with Finn Balor have been pretty good. So it's not like these guys are incapable of going in there and having a very good match, and I didn't think this was one of them. Plus, you had, you know, look at what they did here. Corbin threw a chair at Roman, got himself disqualified so they could do the whole, oh, I'm the GM, so you know what? We'll restart the match, and I'll make it no disqualification. By the way, he should totally talk like that on the show when he cuts promos. So they had, you know, Dolph and Drew came out, and, you know, Seth and Dean came out, and it was just interference galore until finally Roman hit the spear and got the win. This main event sucked. This show was no good. There are some, you know, bright spots that I tried to focus on here, and a lot of the other stuff I just ignored because it's just not worth getting into. SmackDown, on the other hand, was an improvement over last week. It was much better than Raw. 2,400 votes, 42% thumbs up, 6% thumbs down, 52% did not watch. So, you know, thumbs up, thumbs down ratio is very good, but that's still way, way more people than who should be, you know, choosing that option. And I don't doubt for a second whether the number is 52 or even if it's a little exaggerated. I've been getting emails from people for a while now saying that they've given up. You know, they've just given up on the main roster product and they only listen to podcasts and that's how they keep up with things. So I don't doubt that you have a good chunk of the audience who is just not watching. And that's a very big problem that they're going to have to address. But I did think SmackDown was a good show this week. There was a Miz TV segment with Miz and Maryse. The big news coming out of that is that Maryse is once again leaving television. This makes me very sad. She is leaving to go tend to Monroe Sky to be a mom. Daniel Bryan came out and accidentally, you know, rammed into Maryse. Perhaps I should have used a different word there, but rammed into her in a completely, what's the word I'm looking for? In a completely platonic way. And so Maryse teased that she was injured, then she smirked to show that she really wasn't hurt. Anyway, so this is all building to Miz and Bryan at Super Showdown with the winner getting a championship match sometime in the future. They haven't said when. There was a segment on this show with Randy Orton. He was in the production truck, not with Kevin Dunn, but he was in the production truck with some random person, and he was forcing them to show footage of him sticking a screwdriver through Jeff Hardy's ear at Hell in a Cell. He seemed to be getting off on this. And Orton said that what he did to Jeff will pale in comparison to what he does to his next victim. And who that might be, we'll get to that in a second. Cesaro and Kofi Kingston had a pretty good match. Cesaro won with the neutralizer. This is building to a tag team championship match at Super Showdown. Rusev and Aiden English. Now, for the longest time, Rusev and Aiden English, there's been a lot of dissension building there. And then finally, one day, it looked like they had patched up their differences and everything was okay. And what did I say at the time? I said, that's not how this works. Sure enough, everything came to a head here on the show and Rusev Day is no more. And I know there are a lot of people very upset about this because Rusev Day was a very entertaining act. And I worry more not about Rusev. I worry more about Aiden English because, you know, he may be a heel now and he may have one person in Rusev now that he can feud with. But when that feud is over, Aiden English, it ain't going to be good for him. I don't really see this being a plus for him at all. Rusev, you know, he'll be around. Aiden is the one, if I were him, I'd be worried. But they were backstage and they were arguing over their loss at Hell in a Cell because they failed to win the tag team titles. And Rusev said, look, I want you to stay away. I have a United States Championship match tonight against Shinsuke Nakamura. I don't want you out there with me. I want you to stay in the back. And he and Lana walked off, and then we see Aiden. He's talking crap about Lana and how it's all her fault, and the camera pans out, and there's Lana. She heard everything that he said, and she threatened, I'm going to go tell Rusev. She's going to snitch. She's going to snitch on Aiden English. So then comes the match. Rusev has the match well in hand. It looks like he's well on his way to winning the United States Championship. Inexplicably, although I guess we would find out why he did this a few minutes later, Aiden English jumps up on the apron and he yells, he goes, "Rusev, crush!" And this distracts Rusev, who ends up getting rolled up and pinned. And immediately afterwards, Aiden English attacks Rusev, beats him, pummels him with the microphone, and he walks off. So Rusev Day is officially dead. It is officially done. This was inevitable. You know, it's sad to see it come to an end, but you knew it was coming. I mean, you know, you didn't have to be a boy genius to see where this was headed. And now we're going to get the Rusev-Aiden English mid-card feud. Hopefully Rusev will dispatch of this man because he's better than this. And Aiden English, you know, I don't know what happens to him at that point. You know, I think he's a good hand to have. I think this was probably as good as it's going to get for him. I mean, for his sake, I hope not. Maybe they have some other great plan for him, but probably not. And Rusev Day will continue. It's not like, you know, they're not going to have Rusev Day merchandise and they're not going to say Rusev Day every time he comes out. But just as a tag team, as a combo, Rusev Day is no more. And I'm okay with that just because I don't want to say it was played out and the fans still were into it, but it just had been built storyline-wise. It had been building for a while. I'm happy they pulled the trigger. This is what they should have done with Sasha and Bayley. How can I sit here and complain that, oh my God, they broke up Rusev Day when they were teasing for so many months that this is the road they were going down, and then all of a sudden they abandoned it? You know, when on Raw, I'm sitting here just completely exasperated over the fact that we sat through months and months and months of teasing a breakup between Sasha and Bayley. These two fucking people went to therapy. We had to sit through those. We need therapy after those segments. And where did it lead to? It led to nowhere. They made up. Oh, how exciting. What wonderful television. That might happen in real life, but that doesn't make for good TV. And it certainly doesn't make for good TV for Sasha and Bayley, who have just been stuck in purgatory now for months. So, you know what? I'm happy they finally follow through on their own storyline. They pulled the trigger. Aiden English turned heel. He attacked Rusev. Now they'll feud. And they'll go on from there. But this was inevitable. So I don't, you know, I'm not going to cry over this the way that other people are. There was an excellent match on the show between AJ Styles and Andrade Cien Almas. If you didn't see it, you need to go back and watch it. It was the second best match all week on WWE television, not counting Hell in a Cell, just looking, you know, in terms of, actually maybe even including Hell in a Cell. But this was, and as far as what the first match was, we'll get to that when I talk about NXT. But this was great. Almas hit the double knees in the corner for a very, very near fall. He went for his hammerlock DDT, and AJ countered this into a pinning attempt. He then rolled out of his own pinning attempt and somehow ended up with Almas in position for a Styles clash. My words don't do this justice. This was a great finish. It looked, it just was this beautiful transition. He hit the Styles clash. He actually won. First time I've seen him win with the Styles clash in a while. This was a great match. Not the first one these two have had, I don't think. But it looks like Almas is getting a little bit closer each time. And certainly proving that he belongs, I think, in the main event scene with these guys. He belongs in the picture with guys like Joe and AJ and Brian. He's as deserving as any of them. I mean, he may not have the time put in yet on the main roster that those guys do, but who cares? You know, if you're that good, if you belong in that scene, then hopefully they keep him there. Hopefully he's... Supposedly, Vince McMahon has been very impressed by Cien Almas, you know, but Vince can be impressed by something one day and then the next day be like, who? So I don't know that that necessarily means anything, but he keeps churning out matches like this. It's going to be hard to ignore. Joe did come out and jump AJ after the match, but AJ fought him off. They're going to obviously be wrestling for the championship. No DQ, no countout in a couple of weeks in Australia, which leads to the end of the show. The second highlight after the AJ Almas match, which was Becky Lynch coming out for her championship celebration. She is the new SmackDown Women's Champion at long last. Second time now with the title for her. And they are still trying to position Charlotte as the babyface in this thing. They are still being very stubborn on wanting people to sympathize with and cheer for Charlotte in this scenario. And they will continue to fail. As long as they continue with this, they can try all they want to. They can be as stubborn as they want to be. They will continue to fail as far as that goes. Becky, though, they don't have to do a damn thing with Becky. Becky has been absolutely fantastic in this role. I like now where they have gotten with this. Whether it was just lessons learned or just naturally allowing Becky to, you know, go out there and just have, you know, a certain edge to her. She hasn't really come out and done anything, you know, all that sinister yet, you know, and she shouldn't, because that would be forcing her to be something that she's not. If they just stay away from her bashing the fans like she did a few weeks ago to just get cheap heat out of it, I think they have finally gotten to a place with Becky Lynch. She is right where she needs to be. She's straddling that line between babyface and heel, showing, I think, just the right amount of attitude. So they don't have to do a damn thing with her. But this whole thing with Charlotte and being the bigger person and, you know, having Becky always attack her and then showing Charlotte crying and trying to get the crowd to, you know, kind of be on her side. I mean, Charlotte has her share of fans, but the large majority of these people, every time that Charlotte gets her ass kicked, they don't chant for Charlotte. I don't hear them going, Charlotte, Charlotte. They're chanting Becky, Becky. That's who they're chanting for. And that ain't going to change. But, you know, Becky Lynch, she's done a bunch of interviews. She gave an interview to USA Today. And she had this quote I thought was telling. She said, you know, about her character. For the most part, people are generally good and want to do the right thing. And sometimes it just backfires on you. My father used to always tell me no good deed goes unpunished. And I think that's what you're seeing right now with Becky. That she's always done the right thing and it hasn't gotten her where she wants to be. And now she's had enough and she's saying, I don't care who's in my way. You know, there's a reason that people joke and call her Stone Cold Becky Lynch, because that's sort of the attitude that Steve Austin had. It wasn't anything that Steve Austin did to be cheered by people. He just got a certain attitude. He was just pissed off at the world and he wasn't going to let anybody stand in his way. And people got behind it. He was like a rebel on the roster. And that's sort of what Becky is like right now. She's got this rebellious attitude about her and she doesn't give a shit if you're on her side or not. But if you're not, watch out, because she's going to steamroll right over you. There's just something naturally likable. You know, people think it's cool. You know, they gravitate towards personalities like that. And she's also just a naturally likable character. She's been that way on this show now for so long. You're not going to undo that, you know, by forcing this sort of creative change where you think the people are just suddenly going to start booing her and cheering this other person. That's not how this works. So Becky's in a good place. As long as they're not too over the top with like the fan hate, I think they're exactly now finally where they need to be with her. But Charlotte is a whole different story. And as far as what happened in the segment, I guess I should probably talk about that. Becky was being, you know, she was being obnoxious towards Charlotte. She said, look, I want you to raise my hand. I want you to wrap the title around my waist. And Charlotte was good in this segment. She stood up for herself. She also had a bit of, you know, attitude about her. And she went to go leave, and Becky called her a bitch. Second time in this feud that she has called her a bitch. And that was that was sort of the key word that got Charlotte all riled up, and she turned around and attacked Becky, and Becky ended up laying her out and putting her in the disarmer, and they went off the air with Becky holding the championship up high. So I like what they're doing with this now. I think, like I said, that they've finally gotten to a place with this where this is exactly what they should be doing. Now, whether or not they correct themselves as far as Charlotte goes, and they, at some point, doesn't have to be this week, but at some point they kind of get things right where maybe Charlotte starts talking and acting a little obnoxiously towards Becky, and she gets a bee in her bonnet about the fact that the fans have been booing her and cheering for Becky. I mean, think about it. In this feud, of the two, who does it make the most sense for? To go after the fans. It's not Becky. I mean, they could have Becky come out and say, you were never on my side, and we all know that she's full of shit when she says that. But if Charlotte turned around and says, listen, you know, I don't know, I've done everything for you people, I don't know what your problem is with me, but you keep your mouth shut, something along those lines, then it's believable. Because we see it every single week. She gets booed. Even if she's not being loudly booed, Becky's the one having her name chanted, not Charlotte. So, storyline-wise, if anybody has a reason to be pissed off at the fans, it ain't Becky. It's Charlotte. So I think she's being completely miscast right now. Now, to get back to Randy Orton, I was talking before about how he was kind of getting off in the production truck, watching footage of him torturing Jeff Hardy. And who is his next victim going to be? He's moved on now from Jeff Hardy. He's ready to strike his next victim. I say that Miz wins at Super Showdown over Daniel Bryan. And I think it may be Randy Orton who provides the assist that helps him win. Orton is going after people the fans like. Who is one of the most popular babyfaces on the SmackDown brand right now, AJ Styles aside? Who would number two be? I think it would be Daniel Bryan. So it would make sense for Orton to go after him because he is somebody the fans love and he should in turn want to torture this poor guy. Now, the other way they could go with this is they could have Miz win in Australia, get away from Miz and Bryan until WrestleMania, and have Bryan work with Shinsuke Nakamura. If they don't want him working with Orton, he could work with Shinsuke. That's still a match. I know Bryan wants it. I know Nakamura wants it. Other than like a random dark match after a TV taping a few months ago, these two guys have never had a formal match, at least not in WWE. They haven't worked a program together. That's still a fresh match they could go to, and at least it would finally be something for Nakamura to do. He's been doing a whole lot of nothing. So let's say they do that. Let's say they have Bryan lose in Australia, and he transitions into a program with Nakamura for the U.S. title. And maybe you have Randy Orton go after the number one babyface on this show, who is AJ Styles. Styles versus Orton. There's another example of a program that still has not been done. They've had a couple of TV matches, but not an actual feud. Psycho heel Orton against AJ could be really good. The only thing about that is I cannot bring myself to want to see Randy Orton with the WWE title again. I kind of like what Orton's been doing. He's doing his own thing. It's as opposed to Charlotte, here's an example of somebody who's perfectly cast in exactly the role he should be in and exactly the role that he's most comfortable in. But him with the WWE Championship again, I don't think I'm ready for that yet. Not after that whole Bray Wyatt thing and then him and Jinder Mahal. And yeah, I don't know if I'm ready for that yet. But I'll spit out a third option for you. I'm just running through these different things and you know, these different ideas in my head here of how they could go with this. Bryan wins in Australia. And then I'll tell you what I think is going to happen. Bryan wins, let's say, in Australia. And they promote the match for SmackDown 1000. I think some people are forgetting that there's a big SmackDown show coming up next month that they're probably going to want to have a big main event for. And that's SmackDown 1000 on October 16th, which is 2 weeks, right? I think it's 2 weeks or 2.5 weeks after the Australia pay-per-view. If they really want to load that show up and have a big main event, Daniel Bryan challenging AJ Styles for the WWE Championship, babyface against babyface, would be a big one. And then you can have that match end with Randy Orton costing Bryan the match there as opposed to him costing him, you know, the match against Miz. And that then leads to Bryan feuding with Orton. I could see them doing that too. So in my head, I'm mulling all of these options over. What are they more likely to do? I'm still leaning towards a Miz win in Australia. Orton goes after Bryan as his next victim. Samoa Joe loses again in Australia, but probably gets one more match against AJ for the title, and they do that match at SmackDown 1000. Because if Joe is going to win the championship, I actually think it's more likely to happen on SmackDown 1000 to have like a big memorable moment than it is at Super Showdown. Now, speaking of Super Showdown, it is airing live on the WWE Network at 4 a.m. Eastern Time. And there is not a chance in hell I am waking up at 4 a.m. on my birthday. Not unless Katrina is knocking on my door at 4 a.m. So whenever I wake up, I'll watch it. I'll get a review up on the YouTube channel. There's also a big UFC show that night, too. The Conor McGregor fight. So that's going to be a big day. I'll be doing predictions next week. So next Sunday, I'll save my Super Showdown predictions. We'll run down the final card, and we'll do all that on the show next week. Right now, though, this is what the card currently looks like in its current state. And this may end up being the final card, but the way it's shaping up right now, we have Triple H with Shawn Michaels in his corner against The Undertaker, with Mayor Kane in his corner for the first and for the last time ever, but not really, as I like to say. Last time ever being 4 weeks until Saudi Arabia. AJ Styles against Samoa Joe for the WWE Championship. No DQ, no count out, there must be a winner. We have The Shield challenging Braun Strowman, Dolph Ziggler, and Drew McIntyre. John Cena is back. He'll be teaming up with Bobby Lashley against Kevin Owens and Elias. Daniel Bryan against The Miz, with the winner getting a future WWE Championship match. Ronda Rousey And the Bella Twins against the Riot Squad. Charlotte challenging Becky Lynch for the SmackDown Women's Championship. New Day against The Bar for the SmackDown Tag Team titles. Asuka and Naomi against the Iconics. And Melbourne's own Buddy Murphy challenges Cedric Alexander for the Cruiserweight Championship. You know, I think Buddy Murphy will be the king of the Cruiserweights when he wins the title in Melbourne. That's what I'm thinking. King of the Cruiserweights. I'm the king of the Cruiserweights. It's a terrible Neville impression. I do miss Neville. I do miss Neville. I look at some of the talent they have on 205 Live. I look at some of the talent they have just on the main roster. And I think to myself, man, I think the talent they have in NXT, right? The whole story about how Neville even got on WWE's radar was a tape that somebody, I don't know if it was Regal or who it was, but there was a tape that got over to Triple H many years ago that showed Neville again when he was Pac against Ricochet. It was that Neville and Ricochet match that got Neville a contract basically with WWE. Now Ricochet is in WWE. Imagine him feuding with Neville for the North American title in NXT. I mentioned NXT. The only thing that needs to be mentioned here is the main event. An outstanding main event. Champion versus champion, title for title. Ricochet and Pete Dunne put on a clinic on this show that, despite interference at the finish, I think is one of the greatest NXT television matches in the history of the show. I can't call it the greatest because of that finish, even though it makes sense and it builds presumably to War Games in November. But with a finish like that, I just can't rank it as the greatest. I think for me, that distinction still belongs to that 2 out of 3 falls match with Cesaro, that Cesaro had with Sami Zayn. I think it was about 5 years ago now. That was the opposite of a bad finish, if you remember that match, or the opposite of an indecisive finish. That match had one of the greatest finishes you'll ever see, with Cesaro propelling Sami, it had to be every bit of 6 feet, up into the air. And or getting him to a point where he was 6 feet. I'm not saying he alone propelled him 6 feet into the air. He's not Inspector Gadget here. But propelling Zayn up into the air, nailing him with that uppercut, and then finishing him off with the neutralizer. But this one was up there. Two babyface champions. We had dueling chants, which got annoying after a while. This was not a Full Sail's best night. I'm glad they were loud, at least, and they were energetic. I can never really complain about that, but, you know, after a while, when you chant two people's names over and over and over and over and over again, yeah, it gets pretty fucking annoying. But there were more spectacular moves here in this match than I can count. It wasn't all high spots, though. Ricochet went for a 450. Dunne caught him on the landing, immediately locked him in the triangle. Deadlift powerbomb by Ricochet breaks that up. Dunne went for the Kimura. So he's got him in this Kimura, and Ricochet just deadlifts him into position for a brainbuster, drops him down. Out comes the Undisputed Era, attacks both guys for the double DQ. War Raiders come out, they chase them off, and that leaves Dunne and Ricochet with their respective titles alone in the ring, staring each other down in a kind of like a stare of respect. They didn't shake hands or anything, but you know, you can clearly see the respect was there, and that's how they ended the show. I would think that this finish likely leads to a War Games match that has Dunne, Ricochet, and the War Raiders on one side against the Undisputed Era. Bobby Fish, I think Bobby Fish was expected to be out about 6 months when he first got hurt, and this would have been around February or March, and we've pretty much reached that point, so unless he's had some kind of a setback, I haven't heard really any updates on his condition. I would think he's probably ready to go now, or he should be ready to return, I would think, by November. So you could do the four-man Undisputed Era team against the War Raiders, Ricochet, and Pete Dunne. Now, last year they had a 3-way War Games match, so if they wanted to stick to that formula and have 3 teams instead of 2, I guess they could do Ricochet and the War Raiders against the Undisputed Era and leave, you know, Bobby Fish out of it. And then on the other side, have Pete Dunne teaming up with Tyler Bate and Trent Seven. Bate and Seven would make it a better match, so I'm actually okay with either scenario. But these UK guys, I gotta say this too, you know, these UK guys, and I don't know if it was on, you know, intentional or if it was sort of a misspeaking moment there for, I think it was Percy Watson. There was a comment made on commentary that basically suggested that the WWE UK show is coming soon to the network. Now, we kind of deduced that anyway because they've been running some little commercials and vignettes for it. But again, they were looking to see if there was a network, an actual television network over in the UK that might air the show. It sounds like that is not the case, and it is coming to the WWE network. So we're going to get the WWE UK show, and they've got, you know, some tremendous talents from that part of the world who are going to be featured on that show. And every time I see whether it's a Tyler Bate or a Pete Dunne, and there's a bunch of other, and even some of the women they have, I'm just reminded of how deep the wealth of talent is that they have over there. These UK guys are unreal. They are something special. You know, I see people saying, oh, it's scary how good Pete Dunne is, and Pete Dunne's only 24 years old. Tyler Bate is only 21. And he only recently turned 21. He was 20 for a while. And think of the matches that he's had. Think of the matches that he's had with Pete Dunne and the tag team matches that he and Trent Seven have had against the Undisputed Era. This guy is unbelievable. So it's been a lot of fun watching the UK talent. This was week 3 of the Mae Young Classic. The best top to bottom episode of the first 3 so far, I thought. It's become my favorite show of the week. Caitlyn made her return to WWE for the first time in 4 years against Kavita DeVee. Kavita DeVee was trained by the Great Khali, which is terrifying to think about. But he's got a school over there in India, and he's got lots of different coaches training people. He's not the only person coaching them. She lost to Dakota Kai in last year's Mae Young Classic. Okay, she was barely in the business a year at that point. Wasn't very good. She also made her WrestleMania debut this year in the Women's Battle Royal. But that match against Dakota Kai in last year's tournament has done, at last count, just shy of 35 million views on WWE's YouTube channel. 35 million views. And you wonder why they want to break into markets like India and markets like China. Not even Roman Reigns does those types of numbers on their YouTube channel. But I can say this, she looked better this year in the ring than she did last year. I will say that. Caitlyn looked good too. This was fine. I thought the match was fine. Caitlyn hit a cannonball in the corner and a spear to finish off DeVee 2 Advance, although not as good as the Ruby Riott spear that I put over during my Raw review. Toni Storm returns for the second year here in this tournament, one of my favorites. I'm sure one of everyone's favorites. Ginny, her opponent here, is the Progress Women's Champion. Her gimmick is that of a runway model. So appropriately, they showed Tyler Breeze at ringside, and that made me very sad. Just to think of how much I used to really enjoy that gimmick in NXT, and how they never really gave it a chance on the main roster. I'm sorry, a month with Dolph Ziggler is not giving the guy a chance. There was a really cool-looking rolling surfboard that Ginny used here. She was stretching Tony's arms as far back as she could, like Gumby. Tony slipped out, made the ropes. Snap German by Toni Storm, followed by the hip check in the corner, which is really just it's the Usos ass splash. And she hits Storm Zero, which is her version of Ahmed Johnson's Pearl River Plunge for the win here to Advance. I thought this was good. Xia Li and Karen Q. This was the surprising match of the night for me. Surprising in how much the fans were into it, and B, how much I enjoyed it. Xia Li lost to Mercedes Martinez last year in the Mae Young Classic. She's the first Chinese female to ever be signed by WWE. Karen Q was born and raised in Queens, but they bill her from Chinatown in New York, which just sounds incredibly racist, but could very well be true. Maybe she really does live in Chinatown. Maybe that's just the jaded WWE fan in me thinking back to all the other, Asian Americans who came in with gimmicks that made them just look completely stereotypical, and they billed them as being, look, for God's sakes, they took a guy, Yokozuna, who was Samoan, and they billed him from the Polynesian islands of Japan. Now, as a kid, I didn't really notice anything, but as an adult, I watch this and I go, this guy don't look Japanese. But these are the things they did, so hey, excuse me for being a little bit jaded there. I was actually in Chinatown a couple weeks ago. They opened the match, not with a handshake, but they opened by bowing to one another and then took their respective martial arts stances. And Full Sail went crazy for this. That was awesome. That was honestly my favorite moment of the entire episode. Two women I doubt that the fans were all that familiar with. But once they took those stances, it looked like something out of a Street Fighter game, and the people went nuts for it. Q missed, they immediately started throwing leg kicks first, and Q missed a frog splash. Xia Li hit a twisting axe kick coming off the ropes for the win. Fun! This was fun. Main event was Mia Yim against Allison Kay, the former Sienna from Impact Wrestling. Of course, well, Mia Yim being the former Jade from Impact as well. I remember the whole pinkies up brouhaha that, Sienna had last year on social media with Charlotte. I guess that their paths did not cross here backstage on this episode. Perhaps one day they will. Then they can have a pinky swear match. Yim and Kay both made name for themselves in Impact, as I mentioned. They supposedly do not like one another. They played up in the video that they showed before the match that Mia Yim broke Allison Kay's nose in their very first match together on the Indies many years ago. Mia Yim, by the way, I believe I don't know if this is confirmed or not, but it sounds like Mia Yim has signed a WWE contract. So she's not just in for the tournament, she's in for good. They showed Shelton Benjamin at ringside, who was one of Mia's best friends, and Sonya Deville, who Michael Cole oddly proclaimed to be one of his favorite people ever. Tell us more about this, Michael Cole. Tell us more. Or do I want to know the story behind this? Maybe I don't. But he was, boy, was he really waxing eloquently here about Sonya Deville. His whole, tone changed. He was putting her over. These two have worked together a lot of times, so they work pretty well together. This was one of the best matches of the tournament so far. It was not better than the match with Mako and Killer Kelly a few weeks ago, but I'd say this was probably the second best match of the tournament so far, in large part because they gave them time. This match went a while, and a lot of these first-round matches are very, very short. So when you give them a time, a pretty decent amount of time to go in there and tell a story, then you're going to end up having a pretty good match. Now, I say telling a story. One of the stories that they told here, Mia was on the outside of the ring with her, and she has Allison up against the ring post. She goes to throw a chop, and Allison ducks out of the way, and Mia's hand smacked against the steel, and it made a sickening thud. Just this great sound, maybe not great for her, but it made a great sound. She sold the hand for the rest of the match. That was sort of the body part that Allison Kay honed in on. Mia tried for a package pile driver. Allison backdropped her way out of it. She did hit a code red, though, for a near fall, did Mia. And then she hit the eat defeat, Gail Kim's old move, which she calls soul food. And she got the win. Beth Phoenix, actually, surprisingly, dropped a Gail Kim reference during this match, which was surprising in that it didn't get edited off, given all the things, all the bad things that Kim has said about the company, even recently. But this is a very good match. Like I said, I'd call it the second best of the tournament so far. And Mia now faces Caitlyn in the very next round. I believe this Wednesday is also the debut of Io Shirai. So that should be a lot of fun. Lucha Underground this week had not one but two major title changes. So it was an eventful episode that opened with Phoenix and Aerostar having as good of a six-minute match as you could possibly ask for. Zombie Phoenix wins with the Black Fire Driver. This is all Aerostar's fault. I have no sympathy for this man. If he did not go back in time and bring Phoenix back to life, then he would not be getting his ass handed to him like this. It's just that simple. It's like any of you Friday the 13th fans out there, if you ever saw Part 6, and I'm sure you have, Jason Lives, what happens at the beginning of that movie? Jason is dead and buried. And these two dodo brains go to the cemetery and they dig him up. They stick like a giant rod into him, I guess to make sure he's dead. It gets struck by lightning, and it brings him back to life. And then Jason kills one of the guys, right there, on site. Good. Good. He got what he deserved. Just like Aerostar. He's getting what he deserves. After the match, Melissa Santos tells Phoenix, "What's gotten into you? This isn't you." Phoenix grabs her. Dragon Azteca Jr. comes out to make the save. Might I suggest Dragon Azteca watch a little movie called Fear, being that I'm talking about movies right now. I'm on a movie kick now. He should watch a movie called Fear, when Mark Wahlberg kills Reese Witherspoon's friend Gary. I don't know why I remember his name, but I do. Kills Gary in a jealous rage, chases him down in the woods. I think he snapped his neck. Don't get involved here. Bad things will happen. That's the moral of the story. Poor Gary would still be alive right now if he had just minded his own business and stayed away from his girl. Case in point, Phoenix beat the hell out of Dragon Azteca for sticking his nose where it doesn't belong, gave him a black fire driver on the floor. Unfortunately for him, he was scheduled to defend his Gift of the Gods championship next against Marty the Moth Martinez. And Antonio Cueto was about to award the title to Marty by forfeit when Dragon Azteca staggered to his feet and said, I could wrestle. And so Antonio allowed the match to continue as scheduled. Only took about 5 minutes. He was fighting valiantly, but Marty won the title with his new double underhook DDT finish, which has no name right now. And I hear that Marty is looking for a name for his new move. Might I suggest something with the word wings in it? I haven't quite fleshed this idea out yet, what the rest of it might be. But he is a moth, and it is a move where he's, you know, the double underhook. I don't know, I just feel like wings of something, maybe? I don't know, I gotta think about this some more. But this was his first title in Lucha Underground. That means he can cash in for a Lucha Underground championship match, so long as he gives 1 week's notice. Melissa Santos could not have been happy about this. I mean, think about it. Not only has her boyfriend now become a violent zombie, but the man who came to her rescue because of that ended up losing his championship to Marty the Moth, the same sicko who's been creeping over her for the last 3 seasons, every time she would introduce him. We finally got a Killer Cross sighting again here on this show. We saw this guy once and then never heard from him again. To me, I find him to be the most interesting of all the new characters that they've introduced. So I've been waiting for them to do more with him. Paul London told him that he sacrificed the other members of the Rabbit Tribe for him. And Killer Cross said that he and El Bunny, as he called him, the Mexican mini that he keeps locked up in the cage next to him, they want Paul London to show them the way to El Temple. And so he's finally going to be making his debut soon, it looks like. Main event was a three-way dance of destruction for the Lucha Underground Championship. Pentagon Dark defending against King Cuerno and Mil Muertes. I thought they had a good match, but like the opener, only went about 6, maybe 7 minutes. Not a lot of time. It would soon become evident why that was. Pentagon retained the title with a package pile driver on King Cuerno. Marty the Moth came back out, and he laid out Pentagon with the same double underhook DDT that he used to win the Gift of the Gods title earlier in the night. Then he hit a curb stomp. And Antonio Cueto came out and he said that Marty had a great idea last week when he said that the 1 week's notice rule for the Gift of the Gods championship is dumb. He said it was my son's idea, Dario, and my son is gone. And so he's waiving the rule going forward. So I guess we now know what that extra bit of cash was for at the end of the show last week that Marty gave Antonio. So we got an impromptu Lucha Underground Championship match. This thing is now, they've gone full Money in the Bank cash in with this thing now. And we got ourselves a championship match, Pentagon defending technically against his third challenger now of the night. And Marty tied Pentagon's mask at one point to the rope so he couldn't move. This is while he beat on him. Pentagon fought back. He hit a Mexican destroyer, but Marty wisely rolled out to the floor. And with Pentagon's back turned on the opposite end of the ring, Chelsea Green slithered out from underneath the ring, kicked Pentagon in his cojones, and hit a Canadian destroyer. She is from Canada, so it is indeed a Canadian destroyer. And that allowed Marty to hit a package pile driver. He beat Pentagon with his own move. Pinned him. 1, 2, 3. And just like that, Marty the Moth gets his revenge on Pentagon for breaking his arm at the beginning of the season in that Aztec Warfare match. He wins both titles on the same night and ends the show as the Lucha Underground champion. I will say I did not see that coming. That I did not see coming. It does shake up the entire show, which is probably a good thing. It's good to shake things up every now and then. And it is good storytelling with Marty getting his revenge. There is a tie there. It's not like some random guy who just cashed in on Pentagon. He had beef with Pentagon. He had a bone to pick with this guy for, you know, Pentagon breaking his bones earlier in the season. And he got his revenge. He took his championship away from him. And Marty, You know, Marty has been one of the mainstays in this company, or on this show, since the very first season. I keep saying company. It's not, I don't know that it's technically a company. But he's been one of the mainstays on this show now from the very first season, when he debuted as a fan. Think about that. He debuted as a fan. I guess that's kind of how Santino debuted in WWE. And then he won the Intercontinental Championship, you know, like that, I think on night one. So he debuted as a fan on this show, and you know, his character has been through a lot of different things over the years. It's kind of just this off-the-wall, a little bit of comedy mixed in there, but just very unnerving, just a very disturbed individual. And it looks like now he may be taking an even darker turn. Which I welcome, by the way. I like the pair of him with Chelsea Green. I like Chelsea Green being on the show. I think she's very good. And as a character, I think she'll fit in perfectly, I think, on this show. But I think that could be a lot of fun to watch. But for me, you know, with Marty, it was the Weapons of Mass Destruction match that he had a couple of seasons ago with Killshot. That was the first time I remember watching Marty on this show, and I sat up and I really took notice, because before that, I mean, the only thing I knew of him before this show was he was on Tough Enough, and I thought he got screwed, frankly. I think he should have won that season of Tough Enough. I think he was on his way to winning and he got hurt. I think it was some kind of ankle injury. He may have broken his ankle, whatever it was. So that was my exposure to him, and so that was, you know, my knowledge of him going into the show. And like I said, his character has never really been positioned as sort of a top-tier character on the show. Maybe now they're going to try. Maybe now it's just a transitional thing, and maybe he'll drop the championship in a few weeks. You know, again, Lucha Underground's very different than your traditional sort of pro wrestling show, and you get all worked up about, oh, why is this guy not getting a push, and, you know, this and that. And, you know, Lucha Underground I've described before as just, you know, a comic book come to life. It's all these intersecting stories and characters, and guys come and go for various reasons. Guys get murdered. I'm shocked we haven't had any murders on this show the last couple of weeks. So you gotta, I think, look at it a little bit differently. This is the story arc right now with him and Chelsea Green, and we'll see. We'll see if it goes all the way to Ultima Lucha, if maybe he even loses the championship before then. And we'll see if they position him now as more of a serious threat. You know, but it was that match with Killshot, though, that really got my attention, that, hey, this guy is actually pretty good and he can go in there and have a great match. So I don't know if it's just Pentagon chasing now for the championship to try to get the belt back, if they're going to introduce another person into this whole equation and Marty can sort of feud with them. I would think we're in for a chase with Pentagon trying to get the belt back and probably breaking a lot of arms along the way. But I think overall this was a net positive, though, for the show. It shakes things up, like I said, creates a new interesting pairing, and good for Marty. Because, like I said, he's been one of the mainstays on this show from day one. Let's get to your mailbag questions. You can email them to me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. I got a couple of questions about this. I figured I'll address this up front. This one comes from Connor in Tyler, Texas. He wanted to know my thoughts on the whole situation. I'm sure you saw the story. It was on a bunch of websites this week. And on Twitter, there was a woman. Who knows at this point? It was a picture. Her avatar is a woman. It could very well be some dude in his basement. Who the hell knows? But a woman on Twitter named Veronica sent out a series of tweets calling out Roman Reigns and Seth Rollins for blowing off fans. This would have been after a show. I don't know if it was Raw Monday night or a live event. They were recognized in like a convenience store or a supermarket or something like that. And I guess there were some kids and some fans who were, you know, coming over to them and bothering them for some photos. They wanted to, you know, get some pictures. And apparently, according to this person, they did not treat the fans with respect. She said that her dad saw Roman Reigns and Seth Rollins and they were dickheads. And, you know, the couple of pictures that were posted, one is of Roman in the store, you know, and the other is of Seth. And there's a few kids around him. And you can't really see what the hell's going on because there's still shots. It's not like there's video. And also, by the way, who the hell knows when these photos were even taken? You know, I don't remember what shirt Rollins, for example, was wearing in the photo, if it was like a recent shirt of his. These could be photos from a year ago, 2 years ago. We don't know when these photos were even taken. So they became the target of this person's tweets and, you know, trying to make them out to be ungrateful, and, you know, they treated their fans, you know, poorly. Roman Reigns told this person's father that I'm not an animal in a cage and stop taking pictures of me. And anyway, so, but apparently Braun Strowman and Alexa Bliss, the photo of them, you know, there's a photo of the two of them shopping, and oh, they were nice as can be. And, you know, my thought on this is very simple, and I know different people have different opinions, and, you know, if you are a professional wrestler, there is a certain expectation that comes along with that, that, look, people are going to do these sorts of things. You're a celebrity, and it's not just a wrestler thing. I mean, this is for actors, this is for musicians, and so it's celebrity culture, especially in the age of social media and smartphone cameras, and it's not about autographs anymore. Like, I don't give a shit about autographs. You know, you want to get a picture. Everyone wants a picture with the person. So you go up to the person. They could have a fork literally in their mouth at a restaurant. You know, the restaurant would be like a cutoff, right? Restaurants and bathrooms, you would think, for most people would be just like, those are just two zones you don't enter. And there are fans that have no problem walking up to you if you're in the middle of eating and, oh, can I get an autograph? Can I get a photo? There's that famous photo of Randy Orton in the men's room, and it's actually a really funny photo. Orton's washing his hands. He just took a piss. I hope it was just a piss. And he's in the bathroom. He's washing his hands, at least, thank God. You know, Randy Orton, I mean, you never know. You know, I would be a little hesitant to shake his hand. So he's in the bathroom, and he's washing his hands, and he's got this dumb look on his face because he looks up in the mirror, and in the mirror, you can see this kid, and I think the father was with him there in the background. He's snapping a photo. They're in the men's room. And it's one thing, you know, if it's a kid, the kid probably doesn't even know any better. But, you know, if you have a parent there with you watching this whole thing go down, you know, what kind of dumb schmuck do you have to be to think that in any world, on any planet, that something like that would be appropriate? You can't at least wait till the guy comes out of the bathroom. There's only one exit door. What's he going to do, climb out the window? You can't wait outside for him? So this is the sort of thing that happens. There's just certain expectations, I think, that you have to have as a performer, that there are going to be people who do this sort of thing. Now, that being said, they don't owe us shit once they're outside the arena. Once they leave that building, once they're going to their car, once, if they're outside the arena, if they're at a restaurant or a mall or whatever, they are under no obligation to do shit for you. They don't have to sign an autograph. They don't have to take a picture. Now, you can certainly go on social media and you can say, well, this person was a dick. You can do that. That is your right to do that. And there are people who absolutely act like dicks. I've seen it myself. Most people, though, are really cool about it. And they'll be like, yeah, no problem. Like, there are people, like, I've heard Matt Stryker say, you know, listen, I don't care. Unless you see me eating or I'm, like, running to the gate to catch a flight, I don't care where we are or what, you know, what's going on. You can always ask me if you want to take a photo, you want an autograph or something. I've heard, like, Johnny Gargano say the same thing. And that's great. I think that's a great attitude to have. But I'm not going to sit here and bash Roman Reigns and Seth Rollins if this really happened. And again, I tend to think it probably didn't. But if it really happened this way, I don't blame them at all. It's after a show. They're trying to get some food. You got people swarming them. Maybe they were just having a bad night. Maybe they were tired. Maybe it was late. Maybe they just wanted to get back to the hotel. They don't have to explain themselves to us. They're under no obligation to explain to us why they don't want to give a photo, why they don't want to give an autograph. So I don't see why they're positioned as the bad guys here in this situation. Not only that, but this person, this woman, actually went on and admitted, you know, she was going back and forth with people on Twitter and admitted, like, why would you post this? She just wanted to get attention. She admitted, she said, I only posted this because I wanted to get attention and see, you know, how the wrestling fans would respond. And of course, everybody, for the most part, everybody attacked her, I think, and stuck up for Roman and for Seth. As well they should, because they didn't do anything wrong. They don't owe you anything. This sense of entitlement is such bullshit. I don't know where it comes from. I don't know where it started. I don't want to just say, oh, it's the younger generation. Believe me, there's a lot of people who are older than me who have this sense of self-entitlement, and I think it's just a crock of shit. These people don't owe you a damn thing. Leave them alone. That's my attitude about it. Because I'm sure 9 times out of 10, 8 times out of 10, Roman Reigns, Seth Rollins, they're two guys who I actually hear positive stories about. So that's what makes this whole thing even fishier to me, is that I hear more stories about them going out of their way to be nice to people and engage with people than the opposite. I don't hear stories generally about them being dicks to people. It's not like they have a reputation. Some guys have a reputation for that. That's just the way they are. These two guys are not two of the people that I hear stories like that about, which is why I'm skeptical. But if they were having a bad night, if they just said, look, I can't, I don't want to, or I can't, unless Seth turned around and like cussed all of them out or something, that would be a different story. And I'm sure that's not what happened here. But leave these fucking guys alone, for God's sakes. You know, they don't owe you a damn thing. People will say, oh, of course they do. We pay their checks and we bought their house. Again, it's the sense of entitlement. Like, do you hear yourself? And so what? You bought their t-shirt. Oh, okay. Good. Send them a tweet. When he's waiting in line at the fucking convenience store to get a burrito so they can have a late night snack, they don't owe it to you to stand there and take 5 million selfies. So they didn't do anything wrong here. It's somebody trying to stir shit and get attention for themselves. Congratulations. It worked. But in a way, it backfired, because if the goal was to kind of make Roman Reigns and Seth Rollins out to be some kind of villains here, if anything, I saw people just rallying around them, which is a hard thing to do given Roman Reigns, the way people feel about him. But I saw more people sticking up for him than anything else this week, and you can add my name to it too. I don't think they did anything wrong. This whole sense of, you want to go up and ask for a photo, that's fine. I've no issue with that. Look, when WrestleMania weekend rolls around, and I'm doing, you know, the podcast, and we have our own, like, podcast meetups and stuff. Like, I bump into so many people over WrestleMania weekend. It's my favorite part of the whole thing, even more than WrestleMania. I love meeting everybody. There are people who will come up to me, and they're like, oh, you know, can we get a picture? And it's, like, weird for me, because who the hell am I? But I do it. Like, that's me. I have no issue doing that myself. But believe me, I'm not getting the kind of people coming up to me that Seth Rollins is getting or Roman Reigns is getting probably every 5 minutes. But if they can't do it or they say no, you don't go on social media and bitch about it. Unless they were overly mean to you. Like went out of their way to be a dick to you and you didn't do anything wrong. But otherwise, you know, oh, I'm a fan of theirs. I bought a ticket. I bought their merch. I did this. I'm entitled to an autograph. You're entitled to shit. That's what you're entitled to. Last week, I mentioned that Joey on Twitter asked if I could rank my top 10 favorite, or in my opinion, the top 10 greatest WrestleMania endings of all time. This was after I had said that I thought the ending to WrestleMania 10 was one of the best, which it is. I saw it as a challenge, and so I went to work. I put together a list of all my favorite WrestleMania endings, which I think it ended up being around 14 of them, maybe 15. So then I whittled that down to 10, and then came the really hard part, which was ranking them. Ranking is always the toughest part, and it is subjective. I always have to mention that. There are no wrong answers here. Unless you have the ending to WrestleMania 27 on your list, then you would be wrong. So here is my list of the 10 greatest WrestleMania endings, starting from the bottom with number 10, and then we'll work our way to the top. Number 10 on my list is WrestleMania 8. Now, WrestleMania 8 always has a special place in my heart. That's one of my favorite WrestleMania shows. Two awesome matches, Randy Savage and Ric Flair for the WWF title, Bret Hart and Roddy Piper for the Intercontinental title. The best match I've ever seen in Piper's career, certainly in WWE. He never had a better match than he did there with Bret Hart. And then came the main event, which was Hulk Hogan in what was billed as being possibly his final match, and it was for about a year, taking on Sid Justice in what was a pretty horrible match. A horrible match with a horrible finish. A mistimed finish. The whole thing was just colossally screwed up by a miscue. Papa Shango was supposed to come out. It wasn't his fault. It's funny because Godfather did a WWE, one of these photo shoot shows, and he told the whole story about exactly what happened. He was waiting and waiting and waiting, and they sent him out there late. He was supposed to break up the pinfall, and he completely missed that, and then ended up coming down to the ring late. So anyway, the whole thing was just, you know, one big just horrible deal there until, as Hogan was being double-teamed by Sid and Papa Shango and tied up in the ropes, all defenseless, we hear the Ultimate Warrior's theme music, and off to the ring comes the Warrior. He just sprints down that long aisle all the way to the ring. And the Hoosier Dome was a big building. I mean, they had 62,000 people there. He sprints down that aisle, running past everybody, all of the extended hands trying to, you know, trying to touch the Warrior as he comes down to the ring, even though he did look like somebody had put the real Ultimate Warrior in the dryer a little too long. He was still in good shape. But that whole scene was just awesome. And I think, again, horrible match finish, but as endings go, even today, when you go back and you watch that crowd going crazy and the guy sprinting down the aisle and he clotheslines Papa Shango out of the ring and Hogan escapes and now, you know, him and Warrior are basically working together. And this is 2 years after they had their, you know, WrestleMania match. And they were still two of the big, even though Warrior had been fired and this was his first appearance in like 8 months, you know, he and Hogan were still two of the biggest names, you know, in wrestling and two of the biggest names in the history of that company. And now they're face-to-face in the middle of the ring. It was a fun ending. It was this electric atmosphere. As a kid, but even now as an adult, going back and watching it, which I did with all of these endings when I knew I was going to do this list, it's an awesome ending. It really is. It's just this electric, awesome ending. If you can look past, like if you're not a Warrior fan, you're not a Hogan fan, if you could just look at this objectively, that was a hot way to go off the air with a WrestleMania show. And then, of course, they posed, and there was pyro. Big celebration, even though Hogan, he won by disqualification. But anyway, I have WrestleMania 8 here at number 10. Number 9, and this probably will be higher up on some of your lists, but I have it at number 9, WrestleMania 17. Now, I debated even putting this on my list at all, because I hated it when they turned Austin heel. Business-wise, obviously, it turned out to be a bad move. But just judging it from what happened that night, I felt like I couldn't leave this off because it is such a historic moment. You go back and watch it, it does kind of have this, like, you know, epic feel to it. It was like a big deal when this happened. This was a very big thing that happened. And arguably, it marked the end of the Attitude Era. You know, Attitude Era, as I saw it, I mean, the Attitude Era was defined by Austin versus McMahon. Right, there were a lot of other things about the Attitude Era. Rock had his, like, the Nation and DX feud, Ministry, Undertaker. There's a lot of things, you know, that you can associate with the Attitude Era, but it was defined by one feud, Austin versus McMahon. And the minute that Stone Cold shook hands with Satan himself, as JR called him on commentary that night, that to me marked the end of that era. And that then led into what we can call the Invasion Era. Which then led to the Ruthless Aggression Era in 2002. But it is an epic climax to this show. Austin may have turned, but, you know, they were in Texas. And Stone Cold winning the title in the main event of WrestleMania in Texas is not going to get anything other than massive cheers from the audience, which is what this got, even though it took about 17,000 chair shots and the assist from Vince McMahon to beat The Rock. But listening to Jim Ross, you know, spazzing out on commentary, you know, I was in the hospital when he came out of surgery. I thought I knew him. I thought I knew Stone Cold. And just doing this big heel turn that I think a lot of people never thought they would see to end the show. It is a top 10 Mania finish. But for me, it ranks, you know, among the lowest of the 10 and not the highest. But I felt like I just couldn't leave this off. Number 8, WrestleMania 14. The WrestleMania 14 main event, Shawn Michaels defending the WWF Championship against Stone Cold Steve Austin. This was to be Austin's crowning moment here. This was the passing of the torch. They knew Michael's back was just completely screwed, and his career possibly could be over. At the very least, he would be out for a very long time. And so this was going to be the crowning of their new anointed top star, even if Michaels at first really didn't want it to be. You know, we've heard the story about Undertaker taping his fists. Undertaker, he did that interview, you know, that off-the-record interview in 02, before WrestleMania 18, he sat down with Michael Landsberg, and they brought this up, and he actually said, you know, it was going to be a long night for Shawn Michaels if he didn't do the right thing. And in the end, he did. And this was not their best match. You know, they had a few matches before, at least one, like a pay-per-view match, which was at the King of the Ring in 97. And, you know, the last time they wrestled, Austin had not yet been dropped on his head by Owen Hart, and Michael's back was in a better way, and they had a really good match. But here, you know, you had WrestleMania main event, the championship was on the line, and you had the X Factor here in Mike Tyson, who had joined DX on television weeks before. He was the outside enforcer. He was ringside. And this, again, a very big deal. A lot of press, a lot of media around this, you know, hiring Tyson. I think they paid him whatever, a couple million dollars, was the smartest thing that Vince McMahon could have done. Because that singular event is really, I think, what helped kind of bring, it almost helped resuscitate life back into WWE, at least in the mainstream, because, you know, they had ceded first place for so long to WCW. They needed something like this to help get the attention and the spotlight back on them, and in turn back on Austin. It was smart from that perspective too to do what they did, because that just helped elevate Steve Austin that much more. Now, that might not work today if he tried something, you know, if they had Conor McGregor come in and sort of raise the arm of Roman Reigns, he'd probably get booed out of the building. I don't think that would work now, but, you know, Austin was already over. People loved him. People were, you know, cheering for him everywhere he went. He was already the top star. This just sort of, you know, cemented him in that spot. And you have the iconic call by Jim Ross, you know, when the match is over, you know, the Austin era has begun. The impromptu knockout shot by Tyson on Shawn Michaels after the match was already over. It was a memorable finish that served as the official kickoff to the Austin era. And if you watch Raw the next night, the opening segment when McMahon is presenting the new championship belt to Austin, Austin comes out, the only time he ever came out with that winged eagle. When he comes out that night, it just feels. When he introduces Austin, it really honestly feels not like just another episode. It feels like the start of a brand new era. Like they hit the reset button and now this is Austin's show and off to the races they went. So this was a memorable finish. Number 7, WrestleMania 26. WWE had Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker wrestling the year before at WrestleMania 25. And had they positioned that match as the main event the year before this, that for sure would have ended up in my top 10, because that's, to me, the greatest WrestleMania match I've ever seen. And to end the show with a match like that, even if nothing else happened when it was over, that would have been a hell of a way to end that show, but they didn't. It was in the middle of the show. The following year, however, WrestleMania 26, they took their rightful place in the main event. They smartened up and they said, look, anything we put on after this, especially with this stipulation, is going to die a death. So the only spot for this match, even though there's no title on the line, you've got this guy's career against the streak. That's a big enough stipulation that this is the main event of the show. And you had that added drama. You know, will Shawn... Yeah, there were people, I'm sure, who watched that who thought, there's no way that Shawn Michaels is going to lose twice to The Undertaker. He's going to get his win back. Probably newer fans. So there were people who probably thought that Shawn was going to win this match. Oh, his career's not going to be over. He's not that old. Come on. So you had that added drama. Is he going to be the one to break the streak, or is his career going to be over? And these two, yeah, they pulled out a lot of their greatest hits from the match the year before, but I love that finish. You have Shawn Michaels struggling to his feet, clawing at The Undertaker, smacks him across the face. This just enrages The Undertaker. He gives him a super jumping tombstone for the win. He didn't just end Shawn's career with a tombstone. He got some height on that thing and drove him headfirst into the mat. That coupled with, you know, they embraced after the match, the show of respect. Undertaker left. He gave him the ring. Shawn is just looking around, this massive crowd in Arizona, just taking it all in. They didn't play his music or anything. And then takes the long walk down the aisle to go off the air. If Michaels and Ric Flair were in the main event of WrestleMania 24 in Orlando, because they did the same thing there, right? Flair's career was on the line. He lost. Didn't play any music. He walked that long aisle and waved goodbye to everybody. Then that would have been on this list too. That would have been a top 10 finish. I mean, you're seeing the retirement of maybe the greatest of all time. You could say the same thing about Shawn Michaels. And he did it in, you know, after an excellent match. I put that match just a shade below their match at WrestleMania 25. But that's also one of the reasons I'd rather not see him come back for some random tag team match. But again, when the money is that strong, you do what you got to do. And look, if he comes back and he's even 75% as good as he was 8 years ago when we last saw him, then we're in for some fun matches. If he returns for more than just a tag team match. But for over 8 years, this guy actually honored the retirement stipulation. So that adds to it too. Knowing that he was one of the few to actually stay retired, even if he does come back now, I just felt like this was the perfect send-off. Number six, appropriately, is WrestleMania 6. Now, as a kid, I don't know that I could adequately explain to, if you are a younger fan, how big of a deal it was at the time to have Hulk Hogan against the Ultimate Warrior in the main event, champion against champion, title for title, babyface against babyface. You didn't see that back then. And I still remember watching the match live. I still remember, you know, being shocked when Hogan missed the leg drop and disappointed because I fell on the Hogan fence. You know, everyone had friends who were either a Warrior fan or you were a Hogan fan. All these years later, I have no idea why I had the Warrior wrestling buddy for all those years and not Hogan. But I was always a Hogan fan, more than a Warrior fan. So I, like Edge that night, very disappointed by the outcome. But it was an epic match. It really was. And looking back at it now, all these years later, there are people who will probably go back and watch and be like, man, this match was the shits. I can't believe that I used to like this. There's going to be people like that. I go back and I watch it and I think to myself the same thing I thought when I probably watched it 5 or 10 or 15 years ago when I watched it on replay, which is, wow, this match is actually better than it had any right to be. This match was a hell of a lot better than I probably, going in, if I was a little older when I saw it the first time, than I would have expected it to be. There really is nothing wrong with, I mean, there's some rest holds and all that, but there really is nothing wrong with the match. They built what I thought was the best possible match that those two guys could have had. They had themselves a really good match. I would not call this the shits. I would not call this horrible. Hogan and Sid, WrestleMania 8, that was a terrible match. Hogan Warrior, WrestleMania 6, was not. And, you know, the idea was that it would serve, obviously, as a passing of the torch, which it did, temporarily. It didn't last very long, but, you know, for less than a year. But for that year, it was a passing of the torch. They said, we're going to try to go with the Warrior. It didn't work. You know, and Hogan stole some of the spotlight at the end of the match and kind of made it about him, which is, you know, what Hogan does. But look, I thought the whole thing where he presents Warrior with the championship, there's kind of a little standoff there. What's he going to do? It is funny, though, you know, when the match ends, Earl Hebner, he grabs both belts. I think it was Earl. Was it Earl or Dave? I think it was Earl. He grabs both belts. Warrior only takes the Intercontinental title. He's like, no, don't give me the other one, because he knows Hogan is supposed to get the belt and give it to him. Obviously, nobody clued the referee in about that. You know, Hogan hands the championship over and hugs him, and he raises his arm. And then that visual of Hogan on those old WrestleMania ring cards, which may have been the last time they used them, you know, being taken to the back and just longingly looking back at the ring as the pyro goes off and Warrior celebrates his great victory, you know, at the Sky Dome in front of 68,000 people, was an epic WrestleMania finish. And, you know, even as an adult going back to watch it, I thought, well, is it as good as I remember? Yeah. Yeah, to me, this is still one of the greatest WrestleMania endings to a show. So I have that slotted in at number six. And then we get to the top five. Number five on my list is WrestleMania 10. Now, this was, in many ways, I guess the opposite of like that WrestleMania 26 match with Shawn and The Undertaker, Hogan Warrior. Those guys had good matches. Bret Hart and Yokozuna had a decent at best match with a shit finish. I enjoyed their WrestleMania 9 match more than their WrestleMania 10 match, and their WrestleMania 9 match wasn't even that good. The finish here is comically bad. Absolutely comically bad. Yokozuna didn't lose to Bret Hart. Bret Hart didn't beat Yokozuna. Yokozuna beat Yokozuna. Yokozuna had Bret Hart dead to rights. He had him in the corner for the Banzai Splash, And, you know, I remember thinking to myself, did Piper grab the rope and shake it? When you watch, he didn't touch the ropes. Piper didn't touch the ropes. There was no assist. Yokozuna literally, as the finish was laid out here, lost his footing. He lost his balance, and he fell down. And Bret, and not only did Bret Hart pin him, there was a period of probably a good 5 seconds or more before Bret even covered him. And he pinned him 1, 2, 3. This unstoppable force. Yokozuna had the championship for a long time. Nobody could stop this guy, this monster. He falls backwards and gets pinned. You couldn't have Bret, like, try to wrap the tree trunk legs up in the sharpshooter like he did the year before and let the guy just submit, verbally submit. Would it really have killed him? Would it have killed Yokozuna, really, to have him submit for the first time in his career? What a moment that would have been for Bret in the same building where he got Kurt Hennig to tap out in the sharpshooter, that great moment at SummerSlam in 91. Imagine them being back in Madison Square Garden, main event of WrestleMania, trying to wrench back on those big legs, if he can do it. Maybe he just felt he couldn't do it. Yokozuna submits, because back then there were no tap outs. You had to verbally submit. And then you have, you know, you can have the side of Piper going and calling for the bell and everyone, you know, the place explodes. But I guess that's asking too much. So, but of all the finishes they could have done, at least Bret won. That was the right finish, but this was shit. So I admit that freely. You might be asking yourself, boy, I'm really burying this match. Why is this on my list at number 5? Because as far as endings go, I just thought that this is still to this day, going back and watching it, a fantastic way to end the WrestleMania show. And it's great storytelling because A, Bret was the chosen one. The fans had made their choice. This was back when WWE was more receptive to fan feedback because their livelihood depended on it. They didn't have billion-dollar fat cat TV contracts, and they didn't have a network, and they didn't have all the things they do now, all the different ways they bring money in. They didn't have that back in 1994. In fact, business wasn't all that great in 1994. Their bread and butter was, we got to listen to the fans and what they want. And at the Royal Rumble that year, the fans made it very clear that they favored Bret Hart over Lex Luger. So poor Lex got fucked because they never put the belt on him at SummerSlam. They were going to wait until WrestleMania. Well, you know, the best laid plans, you know what happens there. And so they went with Bret. Whatever it was, Bret was hot as hell as you know, with the fans. He was over as anybody in that company, especially, you know, internationally, fans in all these different countries. They'd write him fan mail and all this stuff. So they went with Bret. Bret was going to be the face of this so-called new generation, and they wanted you to know it. And he wins, and Luger comes into the ring, and Luger had been screwed earlier in the night, and he shakes hands with Bret. Piper comes back into the ring. They both raise Bret's arm. Now all the baby faces come out. Most of them who unfortunately got screwed out of being on the show because the ladder match went long with Shawn Michaels and Razor Ramon. And they supposedly got chewed out backstage about it by Macho Man, who thought it was very disrespectful of them to do that. But you had guys like Bob Holly was out there and Tatanka and the 1-2-3 Kid. They were all supposed to be part of a 10-man tag that got bumped off the show. So I guess, you know, maybe part of it was just throwing him a bone. They said, hey, you go out there and celebrate with Bret. So Bret's in there with Razor and Bob Holly and Tatanka. Macho Man comes back out. Burt Reynolds is in the ring. He's hugging Bret Hart. He looks happy as hell. Vince McMahon puts his headset down. He gets into the ring with Pat Patterson. They're all celebrating. They hoist Bret up on their shoulders and everybody cheers. I sometimes forget what it's like to see these WWE crowds actually embracing the person, you know, that's being pushed in that position. And they love Bret. This, you know, they got the person they wanted and they reacted accordingly. And then Owen Hart comes out. Now, Owen had beaten Bret earlier in the night. He pinned him 1-2-3, clean as a whistle in the middle of the ring. He didn't pull the tights. He didn't hit him with a foreign object. He didn't hold onto the ropes. He didn't kick him in the dick. He pinned him. And now he's got to sit here and watch this guy celebrate as the new champion. They zoom in on Owen's face. He mouths the words, what about me? He can't believe it. Macho Man is inviting him to come into the ring. Everybody's looking at Owen. Like, come on, dude, come on in. He doesn't go in. I love that. I love that bit of storytelling there. And just the way they set things up, because you knew at that moment, Owen's got to be the number one contender. I mean, if you think about it, it was kind of ridiculous that he had to win the King of the Ring, you know, just to get a championship match. But they had him win the King of the Ring first. He became the King of Hearts, and then eventually he got his title opportunity at SummerSlam. But just the whole celebration, having everybody in the ring hoist up Brett the way they did and just endorse him as the new guy, as the guy. And that little bit of storytelling there with Owen coming out, I love this. I love this ending so much. And, you know, when you have it in Madison Square Garden, I mean, come on, of all the buildings to have it in. I know it's not a big stadium, but, you know, it doesn't get more big time than that when you have that kind of finish at MSG. Old school, right? You had the little short aisleway and all that. Unfortunately, they don't have that anymore. So the Garden has lost some of its personality. But I thought that this was easily a top five WrestleMania finish. Number four, WrestleMania 31. This was an excellent main event on this show. I don't care what anybody says. I think most people would probably agree with me. I don't think it's an unpopular opinion, but there are people who probably think the match, oh, it's overrated, it wasn't that good, it was just a bunch of, you know, suplexes and Superman punches. That first match that Roman Reigns had with Brock Lesnar, I'm pretty sure that was their very first match, still to this day is the best match that they ever had together. They've had a bunch of matches since then. None have come close, I don't think, to being as good as the match they had at WrestleMania 31. So you had this excellent main event capped off by a shocking twist. It's not very often we get a shocking twist at WrestleMania in the main event. We did it, you know, 17, and we got one at 31. And if turning on the Shield the year before and aligning with the Authority, if that's what made Seth Rollins a headliner and a main eventer, then cashing in at WrestleMania and winning the championship in the main event made him a made man. That elevated him to the very top. And it made for one of the most memorable finishes, I think, out of all 34 WrestleMania shows. It was cool to be in the building that night when his music hit. The place went nuts once people realized what was going on. And then they had that little triple threat match for about 90 seconds there. I thought the finish was great too, you know, Lesnar scooping him up for the F5, Roman comes out of nowhere, he was kind of off screen, he comes in, launches himself with a spear, and then Rollins hits the curb stomp and gets the pin. So it was a very brief sequence, it wasn't a long match there, but I just thought the way this all went down, from the match with Roman and Lesnar, to the little triple threat they had, the shock of Rollins becoming the first person ever to cash in at WrestleMania, he wins the championship, fans were already souring on Roman Reigns. He was already starting to get the boo bird treatment at that point. And, you know, the people were very happy to see them not put the title on him. And, you know, it ended up on Seth. And he got the big, you know, celebration with the fireworks on top of the stadium. And it was a fantastic WrestleMania finish. It actually, I mean, you could argue that it's even top two or top three. I have it at number four. But you wouldn't, I wouldn't say you would be wrong if you wanted to rank it even as the greatest WrestleMania finish of all time. That's how good it was. Number three. I debated where this would be ranked. I never debated whether or not to include it on my list. It was always going to be on the list. It was just a matter of where. But I could see some people not wanting it to be on their list because they just can't wrap their head around having a list like this with Chris Benoit on it. To me, I'm not the kind of person who can't go back and watch an old Benoit match. That has never bothered me. I may not enjoy them quite as much. I definitely look at them a little bit differently because you cannot separate. You cannot just forget about what happened after the fact. But I can still go back and watch, you know, old Nitros and old matches that he was in and enjoy the matches for what they are. And so that to me was never really an issue. But it is very sad, I mean, to say the least, right? It's very sad to go back and you watch the end of this match, you watch the end of this show, knowing what happened, you know, losing Eddie, and then what happened with Benoit. And Eddie, I mean, we lost Eddie the following year. It was the year after that that he died, and then, of course, what Benoit would do a few years later. But if you are talking all-time great WrestleMania finishes, if you make a list, and you don't include this one, as far as I'm concerned, it is not a valid list. It just isn't. You had, first of all, the match, let's talk about the match itself, right? Triple threat match, Chris Benoit challenging for the World Heavyweight title against Triple H and Shawn Michaels. There was a lot of drama. Fans in that building badly wanted to see Benoit win the championship. There were even moments where they, if he was in there with Sean, they were booing HBK. Not a lot, but you could just tell that of the three, the people that, you know, the person that they wanted to see walk out of there with that championship, because the story had been built up for so well for so long, was Chris Benoit. They told the story of a guy who thought he would be in the WrestleMania main event, one of the greatest performers of all time, never really got his just due, never really won the big one, and so here's his opportunity in the main event of WrestleMania. That was basically the story. And there's this great spot near the end. And I didn't really remember this until I went back and I watched it, but holy shit, like the blood in this match. Triple H cut himself open, Shawn Michaels cut himself open. Shawn Michaels did a great, I will say this, he did a great job too, because in the match, he quote-unquote got busted open on a slingshot spot into the post. It happened so quickly, at first I was like, wait a minute, when did he cut himself? And I went back, and you could tell, like, the moment where he did it, but it was so quick. It was so quick that it made you go, well, maybe he really did, you know, hit his head on the post, but he was, you know, he was that good. But boy, he must have hit an artery or something, because Shawn was, it was an uncomfortable amount of blood from Shawn Michaels, and then Triple H busted himself open. And so it's a bloodbath, but there's a spot towards the end of the match where Benoit has Triple H in a sharpshooter. And they had established this on television as a move that he would sometimes use, and the people went nuts. When he put him in the sharpshooter, they thought it was the finish. They erupted. And he's got him in this hold, and they're just begging for Triple H to tap out. And then Shawn Michaels comes out of nowhere, and he super kicks Benoit right out of the hold. And at that moment, you think, well, that may be it for Benoit. He had the match won. Michaels gave him the super kick. That could be the end of his night. Now, Shawn gets dumped out of the ring. Benoit turns around into a pedigree attempt by Triple H. That got countered into a crossface. And this is where all the drama unfolded. You had Jim Ross on the call, losing his mind, of course, as only he can. Triple H is fighting it. He actually rolls through. Benoit keeps the hold locked in, and he's starting to fade, and finally he taps out, and the fans in Madison Square Garden erupt, and they rise to their feet. This was pure wrestling drama to cap off what is still one of the greatest triple threat matches in the history of this company, and really one of the greatest matches in WrestleMania history. Jim Ross is nearly losing his voice and talking about the 18-year odyssey that Benoit was on to get to this moment, and you have all the confetti falling. You have him and Eddie Guerrero. Eddie comes out. Eddie had retained his WWE Championship against Kurt Angle earlier in the show. Now they're face-to-face in the ring. They both have their respective belts. They embrace in the middle. Confetti is falling. It was just a great moment. A great moment in time. And never were two people like Chris Benoit and Eddie Guerrero supposed to headline WrestleMania as champion or win the title in the main event of WrestleMania. And these guys did. I mean, that just would have been inconceivable a few years earlier, let alone 20, you know, years ago, 25 years ago, when the first WrestleMania took place in that very same building. So when you look at it in a vacuum, as its own moment, you wish that you could just sort of bottle it up, and that everything that came after would have just never happened. But it did, and you know, that should never be forgotten. That should never be forgiven. But I can also sit here and objectively say that this is still and will forever be, regardless of what happened after, one of the greatest WrestleMania closes of all time. Number two on the list is WrestleMania 30 at the Superdome in New Orleans. Another WrestleMania I was fortunate enough to be part of. Very happy that I was there. There was actually a lot of really great things on the show that night. From the opening segment, Hogan, Rock, Austin in the ring together. Cesaro body slamming Big Show out of the ring in the Battle Royal. Obviously the streak ending is not something that I agreed with, and that certainly took the wind out of the sails of everybody in that building for the rest of the show until the closing minutes of that main event. Even part of that main event was really butchered by the crowd, because the crowd was still in shock and also disappointment and anger, I think, over what happened in the Undertaker match. The Undertaker match sucked, but the finish, it's maybe the most memorable finish in the history of the business, or of WWE. I don't want to get ahead of myself and say the entire business, but it's up there. You know, as far as WWE, it's probably number one. If it isn't Montreal, it's this. So then you came to the main event. Now, earlier in the show, Daniel Bryan had beaten Triple H. He had to run the gauntlet. We all know the story of him going into WrestleMania. Here's another example of somebody who was never supposed to be in the main event of a WrestleMania. He caught fire, the whole yes movement, and he was never supposed to be challenging for the championship, let alone winning it at WrestleMania. He was, at best, I think he was slotted fifth or sixth from the top in a match against Sheamus. And he said so in his own book. And that is what the plan for him was up to a few months, a couple months before WrestleMania. And then CM Punk walked out. Certain things happened. And they just couldn't resist. You know, Batista was being booed. He wasn't getting received the way they had hoped. He had just come back. And so they did the right thing in the end. They did the right thing and they changed course. And they set things up perfectly going into WrestleMania, where Bryan was the underdog. He'd have to first beat Triple H, and if he could get past him, he would earn a spot in the Randy Orton-Batista match, and it would turn into a triple threat. So Bryan and Triple H, I thought, had a great match to open the show. One of the better WrestleMania openers I think they've ever had. And they attacked him. They, you know, injured his arm. Again, they're building drama for the main event. Will he be able to compete? Won't he be able to compete? Once the main event really got going, I'd say midway through, people really started to sort of wake up and get into it. It was great. It was like what I was talking about earlier, WrestleMania 20 in the main event, you know, in some of the other great matches they've had, this great wrestling drama. Orton and Batista were sort of teaming up together for a while to take out Bryan. Bryan fought back, and we had the great image of him putting Batista... anybody to tap out in this match, I would have expected it to be Orton and not Batista. And Batista had no problem. He was looking forward to putting over Daniel Bryan. And the place is going nuts. Michael Cole doing some of his best work on commentary here. Bryan taps him out. And Cole has the great line, you know, the miracle kid, the miracle kid, the miracle on Bourbon Street. And it was just this storybook ending that the fans demanded. The fans wanted to see it. They got what they wanted, and they got the payoff that they were hoping for. And even after what happened with Undertaker and Brock Lesnar, and as somebody who was there, I can tell you it was not easy to get these people back into this show. Because, I mean, again, it really did just sort of mute the crowd for a while. But they got them back into it, and they, you know, they got the reaction they were hoping for at the end. It was perfect. It was exactly as it should be. Confetti falling, pyro going off. Bryan had both belts because you know, you have the World Heavyweight title and the WWE belt at the time. And just a great finish to what I thought was one of the best WrestleManias in many, many years. I thought WrestleMania 30 and 31 both. Back to back. We got back to back excellent WrestleManias. Which is probably why we ended up with 32 and 33. We go. You got to be careful sometimes when you get what you are hoping for. You go through this sort of low period for a while there. 32 and 33 were decidedly not as good as 30 and 31. I guess there was some good stuff on 33, right? We had the Hardys coming back. We had, what else? What else was on 33? Well, I mean, you had, talk about WrestleMania endings. Had Undertaker not come back, that would have been a hell of a way for him to go out, sort of disappearing into the darkness and leaving his gear in the ring. I considered putting that on this list too. Even though I did not like the match he had with Roman Reigns and him coming back like nothing ever happened, completely negated that finish, I still would have considered putting it in my top 10 just because, as its own standalone ending, I thought it was great. It was very sad and you know, it was as you would want Undertaker's final appearance to be, where he literally disappears into a plume of smoke and the lights go out. And so I thought about it, but I just, I couldn't fit it in the top 10. But anyway, all of this leads to number one. You probably have figured it out by process of elimination. There's a certain WrestleMania I haven't mentioned yet that's kind of epic. And I don't really see how you can't have this in your top 10. Maybe you don't have it at number one. I felt like I had to put this in number one because there's almost this mythical... I don't know, there's almost this mythical feeling about this WrestleMania show. There's been so many stories told about it. And again, whether you believe that there were 93,000 in the building that night, or whether you believe that there were 78,000, there were a shitload of people in the building that night, and you see that wide shot of the crowd, and everybody looks like ants just sitting around. There were a lot of people in the Pontiac Silverdome that night in 1987 for WrestleMania III. And talk about a main event that was the shits. Just from a match perspective, like, even if you're not all about work rate and that kind of thing, like, just objectively looking at this as a match, it wasn't any good. Hulk Hogan against Andre the Giant was no good as a match. Andre was limited. Andre agreed to come back to put Hogan over. He had just had, I don't know if he just had back surgery or he was about to have back surgery. I think he had just recently had back surgery. So he was barely mobile. Andre couldn't move. It was painful. It still is painful to go back and watch him in this match. Hogan, you know, bumped for him and did what he could. But there were some embarrassing moments during this match. But it doesn't matter. It wasn't about the match. It was about what came at the end of the match, right? When he knocks down Andre, and Andre takes a tumble, the place, people start to, you know, get what's about to happen, I think. Hogan hulks up. Andre staggers to his feet. The camera pans back. All you see is just a sea of people in the Silverdome. And Hogan reaches down, he picks up the Giant over his head, and he slams Andre the Giant. And the place comes unglued. Hogan hits the ropes, hits the leg drop, gets the 1-2-3. Hulk Hogan retains his championship. Didn't even win it. He was already the champion. So he retained his title in the WrestleMania main event. He slayed the Giant. Now, he and Andre had wrestled before. In fact, he had body slammed Andre before. All this talk about Andre being undefeated for 15 years was bullshit. That was complete BS. Andre has never been slammed. Bullshit. Again, not true. Hogan himself had slammed him many times before. Shea Stadium. They had a match at Shea Stadium back in, was it 1980, I think it was? And he slammed Andre like it was nothing. But they did such a good job. And again, you didn't have the internet and social media back then, but they did such a good job of at least trying, I thought, to convince people that this guy had never been slammed. He was undefeated. Nobody could beat him. And it was your typical David versus Goliath story. They had been the best of friends. Andre ripped the chain from his neck. This broke Hogan's heart. Andre, what are you doing? Why are you aligned with Bobby Heenan? The way they set this match up was great. And it was, you know, David and Hogan was just, you know, I mean, jacked to the gills. He was a monster himself back then, but Andre still towered over him. Andre was still a giant compared to Hogan. And you had that dynamic of them face to face in the middle of the ring. And with the epic finish, and as important, I think, as that show is, and that show has gone on to become, I mean, it's just part of wrestling lore, you know, WrestleMania III. There were nobody who I've heard from who listens to the podcast, but I know there are people over the years who have popped up online who said, oh, I was at WrestleMania III. And they've actually posted photos online, you know, old photos that they took in the Pontiac Silverdome that night. And every time I come across this, it's just amazing to me because these are images I've never seen before. And you're so used to seeing the same photos and the same video from the same camera angles. When you see photos from like different perspectives of people who were actually in the building that night, it reminds you like this was just a wrestling show. People bought tickets and they went like any other wrestling show. But like if you were in the building that night, I can't imagine what that must have been like. You know, and so the myth and the legend of this show has only grown over the years. And Hogan slamming Andre to me is the quintessential WrestleMania moment. It's the quintessential WrestleMania finish. I don't know that there's ever been a better finish than that. It's just this iconic image that can never be topped. And so I couldn't put this anywhere but number one. I thought, well, maybe it, you know, should be lower on the list because the match itself wasn't that good. And then what do I put at number one? I could do Daniel Bryan at number one, but I don't know because, again, it just, it can't live up to that moment at WrestleMania III. So I just felt like I had to put that at number one. I just don't know that there's been a more epic moment than that to kind of close out a WrestleMania show than WrestleMania III. So this was fun. I like talking about this stuff, man. So hopefully you don't disagree too much with my list. If you do, you know, let me know your list. I'll put this up on YouTube as well. So if you're listening to this on the YouTube channel, leave a comment below. Do you agree, disagree? What is your list of the top 10 WrestleMania finishes look like? What's your number one? Everybody's going to have a different answer about this. I don't want you to just tell me. I want you to explain why, like I did here. You don't have to be as wordy as I was. I have a show to do, see? So I can just talk for as long as I want. There's no time limit on this, so I just kind of wax eloquently here. But now let me know what you think. I want to get your feedback too. This was hard. To rank them was harder than I thought it would be. But ranking them is always the toughest part. But thank you to Joey for the idea. I'm glad that you you pitched it, and hopefully you guys enjoyed this. We'll do a few more questions really quick here, actually. I was going to wrap up, but let's do, two or three questions. Rick in Salt Lake City, what do you think is the worst WrestleMania loss? Booker T jobbing to the Boogeyman, Chris Jericho jobbing to Fandango, or Kane jobbing to the Great Khali? If you have any others, just mention it. These are the ones that come to mind where the win led to nothing. Although Khali did become world champion a few months later, but he always sucked. Wow. Say how you really feel, Rick. So Rick wants to know what I think is the worst WrestleMania loss. I'm going to say Sting losing to Triple H. Amir from Blackburn, UK. Now that Hell in a Cell is in the books and AJ Styles retained the WWE Championship, do you think now is the perfect opportunity for them to keep the title on him to surpass CM Punk's record of 434 days as champion? If anyone is more deserving to break Punk's record, it's AJ Styles. I would not mind seeing him hold the title for 500 days or more. What do you think? Thank you, Amir, for the question. And this is not a knock on you, but, you know, man, I really don't see what the big deal is about the number of days that people hold these titles. Like, it kind of felt special at one time, but now I feel like every single champion, whether it's in WWE or it's in NXT, oh, they've been champion for 250 days. They've been champion for 314 days. They've been champion for 434 days. It's like, who cares? I'm at the point now where it's like, it's so played out to me, I don't even care. Who cares? Who cares about CM Punk's record? And who calls this a record anyway? Like, when did this become a record, by the way? It's not even a record. Bruno Sammartino held that championship a lot longer than he did. So did Pedro Morales and Backlund and Hogan. I mean, so I don't know where this whole notion about, you know, a record comes from. I think people just use that word so often, they just sort of believe it after a while. Or maybe they'll say, oh, the modern era, whatever that means. But no, he doesn't hold a record, dude. Like, he had it for a long time. That would be like, I'm trying to think of like an analogy I can use here. It would be like, you know, if the Mets, okay? And let's say that the Mets have a certain streak of like, I don't know, 40 straight games where they didn't surrender a single run. That's pretty impressive, right? Well, let's say the all-time record is that the Florida Marlins hold the official all-time record of like 60 games, which would be impossible. But let's just say 60 games without a run scored from the opposing team, right? And people are talking about the Mets record. Well, that might be a record for the Mets, but that's not the MLB record. They're at best number two. Well, nobody gives a shit about you if you're number two. Who holds the record? It's the Marlins. It's not the Mets. So it's that kind of logic. Like, I'm so over this whole CM Punk record thing. There's no record. Who cares? And I'll be honest with you. I'm getting bored. Maybe we need to start shaking things up a bit. You start having too many guys that are, this guy's champion for 500, 400, 300 days. Like, let's shake things up a little bit. Maybe that's part of the problem here. Maybe guys are holding championships for too long. Maybe that's part of the problem. Davis from Tempe, Arizona. I don't know if this has been asked before, but did you watch the WrestleMania Rage Party that aired the day before WrestleMania 15? If so, what did you think of it? Not only did I see it, I've talked about it on the show before. I liked it. If nothing else, you should watch it to see Isaac Hayes performing Chocolate Salty Balls while Vince McMahon clucks like a chicken. Or I guess as he would call it, dancing. But he clucks like a chicken. I also laugh when they cut to the corporation at one point. The corporation's up in like the balcony somewhere watching the concert. And you see Vince McMahon, like Kane is just standing there in full costume. And Vince is just yelling at him. He's like, loosen up. It's a party, damn it. Loosen up. So anyway, it was a fun time to be a fan. One more here. This is a non-wrestling question. Speaking of the Mets, Alberto in Laredo, Texas, do you think Jacob DeGrom deserves the National League Cy Young Award? He is one of the few bright spots for the Mets all season. Only thing stopping him, I would think, is a losing record. Well, it doesn't matter. He absolutely should win the Cy Young Award. If he doesn't, then the fix is in. I mean, that's just all there is to it. I saw one stat where it said that he's held his opponents to 3 runs or less in 28 straight starts. Something that nobody in MLB history has ever done before. So you tell me. Does he deserve it? You bet your ass he does. If you have questions for the mailbag, keep emailing them. TheSolomonster@gmail.com. I love hearing from all of you. Even if I don't get to your questions on the show, do know that I read everything you send me, even if it's not right away. So you can email me there. You can follow me on Twitter @Solomonster and on Instagram. I know I don't use it as much, but I am on Instagram. TheSolomonster is my name on there. Next weekend, we are going to do predictions for Super Showdown. Since the show is the following Saturday, October 6th, I'm not going to really have time that weekend to do predictions beforehand, so I'll do them next Sunday. We'll run through all the matches on the show, all the other late-breaking news, of which I'm sure there will be plenty. And we'll get to more of your questions. We'll have some fun, as we always do, every Sunday. Thank you, as always, for all of your support. You make these shows so much fun to do. And I appreciate the hell out of you for it. I will be back next Sunday. Take care. Be well. Stay safe. Don't get into any trouble. I might lose my mind this week here in New York. We have the UN General Assembly. Every time the UN General Assembly is in town and the president is in town and all the heads of state come to town, it just completely fucks up all the traffic in Midtown Manhattan, which, of course, is where I work. And so it's just a circus. It's an absolute... I don't know who came up with the bright idea of putting the United Nations in, of all places, the middle of New York City. Whoever came up with that idea is friggin' brain dead. Why isn't it in D.C.? Why can't it be somewhere else? Why does it have to be in the middle of New York, where traffic is already the worst probably it is anywhere else in the world? I'm already getting stressed out over this. Shanti. Shanti. I'll see you next week.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solomonster sounds off.
They have Kane in the back. This is what he said. Tonight, I will delight as I enter the abyss with a fellow monster. But it is I who will climb out alone and with a smile across my face.
Oh, oh my God.
What do they think this is, Shakespeare?
I was driving yesterday, and some asshole double parks his car in the service lane.
I should have cut a promo the way the WWE would script one out for me. Why art thou parking like one's smelly orifice? I wish 1,000 deaths upon thee. Then I could do a fucking tope and we could fade to commercial.
The Monster sounds off.
Since 2007, The Solomonster sounds off. Available at thesolomonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solo Monsters sound off.